All right, this is Karen Brewster, and today is January 4th, 2020, and I'm here with Sandy McDermott at her home in Corona, California, or Eastvale. I guess, California. And this is an interview for the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park Oral History Project. Thank you, Sandy, for having time to see me today.
Oh, thank you, Karen. Always happy to talk about Klondike.
Okay, well, before we get to Klondike, we're going to get a little bit of an overview of your personal background in history. So you said you grew up in Alaska?
I did. I born in Illinois, but my father worked in an arsenal, and it was the time, I can't think who sang the song, whether it was Arlo Guthrie or someone else, about McNamara closing down the defense plants. And so my father was given a choice. Either leave federal service, he was civil service, or he could go to work for the contractor who took over, they privatized the arsenals. Mm-hmm. And he could work for the contractor, or he would go wherever the government offered him a job. And where the government offered him a job was at Fort Richardson in Anchorage. And he took that, which turned out to be an excellent choice, because while the contractor took those federal employees in, within a year they fired all of them.
Oh. So he went with where the government sent him.
He said he was a child of the Depression. He had 20 years in with the federal government, and he would go wherever there was a job. And so we left all our families and friends and moved to Alaska. And I was a sophomore in high school.
And so what year was that?
1965.
Oh.
And we drove up the Alcan, which was then primarily a dirt road.
Right.
And it still had the signs on curves. Four died here in 1955.
Wow.
And you hit another curve. Three died here in 1963. There were cross markers.
Yeah.
It was still a very primitive road and experience. And when I moved to Anchorage, I think the population was about 50,000 for Anchorage, 60,000 for the whole area,
yeah,
including like Rabbit Creek, and Spinard was a separate town.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and also and, Fort Rich being out in the Eagle River.
Towards the Eagle River. But we lived in town, lived near West High.
Mm-hmm.
It was the year after the earthquake.
I just wanted to ask, it was after the earthquake.
Yeah, and so there was only West High. East was had been built, but we were doing half-time with East students while they were doing repairs to East High School, so those students could go back to school at East. And so they did, if I remember correctly, it was juniors and seniors went from 7 in the morning till noon, and then sophomores went from noon till 5 or whatever it was. But anyway, we went very early in the morning. And so we lived near West High. We were in Spinard.
Mm-hmm.
99503, as Mr. White Keys would say. And in fact, the apartment we moved into had sunk in the earthquake up to the roof in Turnagain, but had been pulled up and moved to where we lived. And where we lived is roughly the corner of, let's see, Arctic. No, yeah.
Yeah.
And C Street. In fact, the road ended at C Street.
Right.
Arctic was gravel,
mm-hmm,
between Fireweed and C Street.
Okay.
And so we were on the very edge of town.
Right.
Which, and it was all tundra beyond us.
Wow.
And mountains. And my mother painted, and so she liked that, having that view right from the deck of our apartment.
Nice.
So that's where we lived. And in fact, many years later, when the Alaska Regional Office was building its new building,
mm-hmm,
downtown in Anchorage, and we were moving out of the building on Gamble Street, before the building was ready, we were just stacked in there. So a decision was made to move a division out of the regional office on Gamble Street And they moved cultural resources over to a building on C Street and Ide. And the parking lot for that building was where my bedroom was. That's where my apartment had been.
That's funny.
They moved us there, I think, because the resources library was in the other part of the building or right next door to it. I don't remember which. But they moved us there in the interim until we moved downtown.
Yeah. So do you have siblings?
I do. I have a brother who's much older and never moved to Alaska. And then I have a sister who's a couple years younger than me. She somehow always figures out she's 4 years younger than me, but she's really only 2.5.
But so it was the two of you growing up?
The two of us. Yeah. Yeah, in Anchorage, which was a great, wonderful time to grow up in Anchorage.
Yeah. And then you went on to college? And
yeah, I went to Colorado State University my first 4 years of college, where I was a music major. My first, we had quarters there, and so my first 4 quarters I was a music major, which meant I had 76 credits in music and not much else, and decided that that was not what I wanted to do, that it was making something that was a great pleasure to me hard work.
Yeah.
So I then became a philosophy major for a couple quarters, and then changed to psychology. And then Colorado State raised its out-of-state tuition, where it just was not going to happen. And University of Alaska Anchorage had opened, okay, where it was really going. And so I went back to Alaska, as we so often do. I used to call it the yo-yo effect. You move away for good how many times,
right,
and then you move back. And so I went back to Alaska, and I finished a degree in psychology at UAA.
Okay.
And then decided that wasn't really what I wanted to do. And then I went to my true love, which was history. And so I got a degree in history.
A master's degree or a bachelor's?
First a bachelor's.
Okay.
So I got my second bachelor's at UAA. And what I was going to do, my plan was to get a teaching certificate and teach secondary school. And so I had my history degree, and I had everything done in the education requirements except student teaching. When they changed the education, the requirements, the state changed the requirements, and of course, once they're changed, there's no grandfathering in.
Oh, right.
And so they wanted a social science degree. So that meant another year of school. And so I started doing that, and then I thought, you know, what I really want to do is go to graduate school. And so I applied and got a full fellowship at University of Oregon's history department, which at that time was a very good, still is, a very good history department secondary program. Mm-hmm. And so I went in as a fellow, and that was 1982. In the meantime, I had married and had 2 children. And so it was, you know, how am I going to manage? And the marriage was falling apart. I knew I had to have a future. And it was, how am I going to manage graduate school? Well, my father had retired, and he went to graduate school with me.
Wow.
My children were 4 and 5 when I went. And he said, oh, you want me to go where it doesn't really snow much, and it's not very cold in the winter, and spend all my time with my grandchildren? This sounds great. So I will be forever grateful to him, because he made it possible for me.
Yeah.
And so I went to University of Oregon, and my intent was to get a master's and then PhD. But through the master's program, when I was about to get the master's, the divorce happened, and it was chaos in my life.
Right.
And so I decided to go back up to Alaska and deal with my home and the divorce. At that time, it seemed like every woman I knew in graduate school, and there weren't that many, history departments were very much a male bastion.
Hmm.
In fact, we noticed of the fellows, 15 fellows came in when I went in. And in the history graduate program, they have what they call standing seminars. And if your primary field of study, for example, is American history, as mine was, then you're in the American history standing seminar. And I was the only woman in the American history standing Wow. seminar. And then if you were doing European history, there was a European history standing seminar. And my friend Judy, who I made friends with at graduate school, she was the only woman
Wow.
in the Western.
And this was in the 80s.
This is in the 80s.
Wow.
And we viewed ourselves as the token.
Yeah.
We were the tokens. And there was one other woman in the graduate program that came in of the 15. And she was in the was doing Asian history. And so...
And she was the only there one she was. In that.
But she was the only... Well, she and I were both in the Asian seminar because what I developed as my primary field of study was I was doing a Pacific Rim specialty. And so it was the American West, the Canadian West, Alaska, Russian America, mm-hmm. and Japan. And so I also was in the Asian Standing Seminar. And then my primary interest was indigenous peoples. And stemming from my view that if you want to really understand a country's policies, and I've always been a policy wank, that you can publish policies, but it's how you implement them that makes a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a civil rights commission and Strom Thurmond is head of that civil rights commission, it gives you an idea of what that's going to accomplish.
Right.
Nothing.
Right.
And so I thought if you really want to understand a nation's policies, look at how they treat the weakest citizens. And inevitably and unfortunately, indigenous peoples in our time
mm-hmm.
seem to have been those in the recent past, the last 200 years, let's say, and maybe always, who have been politically and economically the weakest citizens.
Right.
And so I did a specialty, and that's so I chose to look at treatment of indigenous peoples. And then my master's thesis was on the United States Board of Indian Commissioners that was part of the celebrated peace policy of President Grant.
Hmm.
And when you looked at that board, the initial members of it were philanthropists. They were people who, the person who brought the Salvation Army to the United States, they were people who truly cared about the American Indians mm-hmm. and their treatment. And this was in 1870. That board had resigned in protest because none of their recommendations were being followed. And the policies that were coming out were really that of annihilation
mm-hmm.
and assimilation. And so when we look at the Custer battle is 1876, when you look at the makeup of the board in 1876, it is primarily made up of directors of railroad companies who right. had their own interest
right.
in the treatment of Native Americans,
right.
of American Indians. So that was my field of study.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had said that your father came to help. Was your mother not in the picture anymore? Or?
No, my mother stayed in Alaska,
oh.
and actually my brother's son was living with them
okay.
at the time, and so she was taking care of him. And then later on, her health was starting to deteriorate. So your father came? Yeah, just Dad came.
Neat.
Yeah, it was. So then I went back up to Alaska to settle things out, and I thought, well, and I'll figure out, you know, going back to do the PhD, the last two fields,
mm-hmm.
and do the PhD. And I got a call from UAA, the history department, and Dr. Haycox called me and said, "You're back." And I said, "Yes." He says, "You got the master's." I said, "Yes." He said, "Do you want a job?" I said, what? Here I am, a single mother with no job. And he said, we've just had someone quit who teaches history classes. Can you take them over?
Wow.
And I said, I'm not ABD yet. And he said, we've just combined the community college and the university systems together. Mm-hmm. He says, we have lots of professors here who don't have PhDs. And so I went to UAA, and I was there from 84, and I kept teaching until 1997, actually.
Oh, even after you were with the
even
Park
after
Service.
I was with the Park Service, yeah. I loved it. I loved being on faculty.
Yeah, well, that's what Rachel Mason at the Park Service, she's doing the same thing. She's mixing positions.
So then I'm at UAA, and they were forming Alaska History, the Journal of Alaska History.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was participating in that. I don't remember if I was officially on the board of it starting out, but not sure. And I met Bob Spoody, who was then regional historian for National Park Service. So we get to talking, and he says, so your field of study, Pacific Rim, your language, Russian, for graduate school. And he said, we need somebody to do the boundary review for the Pribilof Islands National Historic Landmark. It was one of the first National Historic Landmarks in Alaska. And I don't know if this is true or not, but I always look at it this way, that I think it was Senator Greening went, oh, we're a state now. There's these things called National Historic Landmarks. We want some of those. It'll be here, 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 and here. And Skagway was one of the first, or if not the first.
Mm-hmm.
And then Pribilof Islands were part of that. But no boundary reviews had been done. And this becomes really important to understand later, even for Skagway. You can designate a National Historic Landmark. And you say, okay, this is a National Historic Landmark. Klondike Gold Rush.
Mm-hmm.
Pribilof Islands. But because the National Historic Preservation Act also affords protection to historic properties, and those, now these properties were designated before the Act of 1966. They were designated in 63, I think, 62 or 63. There's a very short history done, like 3-page significance description. Bam, you're a National Historic Landmark. Well, the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966 takes the National Register of Historic Places and National Historic Landmarks and more clearly defines what they are. And it also provides for a process by which, under the expenditure of federal funds or a federal permit, the qualities for which something is a National Historic Landmark or listed on the National Register of Historic Places must be taken into consideration. And that's the Section 106 process.
Right.
That's
the compliance.
The compliance process. There are no compliance police. It has no penalties. It has no fines, unlike the Archaeological Protection Act, which has civil penalties and fines associated with it. The Historic Preservation Act does not. In addition, it also created a whole panoply of programs. And here's the beauty of the National Historic Preservation Act, is the National Historic Preservation Act recognizes that preservation occurs at three different levels. It occurs at the national level, and what occurs at the national level is that overview and perspective that comes from looking at the country as a whole and saying, what are the things that we choose to remember that tell us who we are as a people? Then it also created the State Historic Preservation Offices and a mechanism to provide federal funding. Originally it was 80 federal, 20 state. I don't know what it is now. I think it went to 70-30. It may even have changed further from there. But the concept was people in their own state also have a vision statewide of what is important in our state. And so if you look at Virginia or Georgia, you're maybe plantations are important, but they're not going to be important at all in Alaska because
right.
we never had them.
Right.
But what will be important in Alaska? What tells Alaska's story? And then it also recognizes by creating certified local governments that local governments could participate in this three-tiered national program because they can look at their own community. And here is where, in my own personal view, local is where preservation happens. Because if a local community doesn't care about a building or a site or an archaeological site or a sacred place, somebody in Washington, D.C. can't do anything about preserving it.
Right.
Because remember, the law under which things are listed on this National Register of Historic Places, either at national, state, or local significance, still has the same protections. It's advisory.
Oh.
It says, we all agree, this is really important. This is important to who we are as a people. But what happens to it is determined really in that local community. Mm. And how communities protect their historic properties are through local ordinances.
Right.
Really, that's the only place there's any teeth. Unlike Great Britain, where they, if something is a national treasure, it's a national treasure.
So
it doesn't matter who owns it.
But if something becomes listed on the National Register of Historic Places in a local community, does that give it extra protection?
It gives it extra protection only if federal funds are being used in a project or a federal permit. If you own a building that's on the National Register of Historic Places and you are not using a federal permit, you are not using federal money, you can do anything you want to that building.
Oh.
You need to understand, and part of my job as a historic preservation officer in Alaska and in Washington, D.C. for the whole Park Service, was to let you know, well, what you're doing is going to destroy those qualities for which it's eligible. Can we talk about it?
Right.
Can we find a way to maybe meet your goal, your need for this building, without destroying the qualities for which it's eligible, which means the qualities that tell the story? And actually, that sometimes works. When Mark Air, remember Mark Air in Alaska?
Alaska, one of those early airlines.
Yeah, they were going to start flying out to Dutch Harbor. And Dutch Harbor, certain buildings there were National Historic Landmark from World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the old aerology building that sat on the runway, which is where during World War II, you have pictures of guys with binoculars, you know, looking out the windows of the aerology building, and they're looking at fog because it's the Aleutians.
Right.
But they sort of ran the airport, right?
The weather,
who comes in, who goes out. Well, Mark Air was taking over had bought the aerology building and was going to turn it into a kind of a VIP terminal and have offices there. So I wrote them a letter, which our then associate for cultural resources in Alaska, Paul Hartel, he says, I'd get him to sign it. He'd say, is this another one of your crackpot letters? And I'd say, yes, it is. Sometimes they work. So I sent Mark Air a letter, and I said, do you realize that this building is part of a National Historic Landmark, and it's important for these reasons, and we'd be happy to work with you so that you can, you know, meet your needs and still maintain its historic qualities. Well, dang, if Mark Air doesn't contact me and say, wow, this is really great. They not only rehabilitated the building, but they restored it.
Wow.
It looked just like it did during World War II. They did a beautiful job.
Well, I'm glad they did something positive with the money they made.
Yes. And in fact, they were going to fly us out there for the dedication of the building and stuff. We couldn't accept free tickets, of course, because we were federal employees. So we had to somehow find the money to get out there.
I was going to say it was too foggy. You couldn't get there.
No, we spent a lot of time in the Aleutians. Anyway, so that's
so something is designated a landmark.
Right.
That's different than being a, how is that different than being a park or a monument or something?
A national park is managed by the National Park Service and is owned by the people of the United States. Mm-hmm. A National Historic Landmark can be privately owned, commercially owned. It is simply a designation that says this is not only nationally significant, but it has, there's criteria for landmark, which is rarity. It's the only, it's the best of. Its condition is. It's the only place the story is told. It's the best place to tell the story.
So there are cases where something gets designated a landmark, and then does it maybe eventually become a monument or a park?
Yes, and that happened with Skagway.
Okay.
And then to go back to my first job with Park Service, so I got Spooty hired me to do the boundary review for Pribilof Islands. Because, as I said, when it was designated a landmark, and then I got off on what landmarks are, it didn't set any boundaries. So boundaries, you think, well, what do they matter? Well, if there is a compliance action, you have to know, is this federal funds or federal permit taking the action taking place within the boundaries of the landmark or without? Because something could happen at Dutch Harbor, for example, that wasn't anywhere near the landmark if you don't know what its boundaries are.
Right.
So Park Service began doing, and think it takes time for, the National Historic Preservation Act was passed in 1966, but it takes time for people to figure out what it means, for all the programs that are in it to get up and running. The Tax Act program is in there, National Register, National Historic Landmarks, Certified Local Governments. What else is in there? Historic American Buildings, Historic American Landmarks, and Historic American Engineering Record, which had actually come out of the 1935 Act, but were now in there. So you have all these programs, and in the Act it says, whenever it says the Secretary of Interior shall, in the definitions, it actually says it means the National Park Service shall. So the National Park Service not only has its parks, and there are the designations of park, historical park, battlefield, recreation area, national seashore. There's all these different designations. They're really all administered the same by the National Park Service. Preserve.
Right.
Those are places that have clearly defined boundaries that are, they're not owned by the National Park Service because they are owned by the American people. But the National Park Service manages and administers them for future generations unimpaired. We have a preservation mission, not a conservation mission. Conservation as well, but we also have the layer of preservation. That's what separates us from BLM and fish.
Right.
We're responsible for them. We have much more control over a National Historic Landmark or a National Register property. Like I said, that really is up to local communities.
Right.
To take care of their own.
So you did this boundary survey, what year was
for,
that?
For 1984.
Okay.
No, 85.
Okay.
85, 86. I did the boundary review for Pribilof Islands, which for the National Historic Landmark name should always reflect its historic name. And so I named it Seal Islands because that's what it been, the St. Paul and St. George had been called.
Yeah.
Most often.
I know the Seal Islands. I know the history of fur seal hunting there, but I didn't realize they'd been called Seal Islands, but it makes sense.
Well, yes. And so I did that study. And then the next summer, you could do a faculty hire non-competitive. So I had the language, I had the background, and I was a faculty member.
Right.
So I was easy peasy. And in fact, it wasn't until I became regional historian that I found that I was like the fourth or fifth person they hired to do the Pribilof Islands. Nobody had produced anything, which sometimes happens.
Right.
So anyway, then the next year I got hired back again as a summer faculty hire, which was great for me because there I was, single parent with children, and I wasn't teaching in the summer, so I wasn't getting a paycheck in the summer. So I went to work for Park Service, and I worked with the wonderful Bill Brown on his Gates of the Arctic. And so I helped him whatever he needed.
He was working on the history.
Yeah, he was doing the administrative history of Gates of the Arctic. What did he end up calling it?
Yeah, I know the name, but I can't think of it.
Left my brain for the moment. And also all the Habs Hare, the Historic American Building Survey, Historic American Engineering Record, documentation had been done in the area of Gates, and so I put all that together, put the photographs together, the history together, the descriptions together, which was his volume 2. And so I worked on that the second year. And then UAA adjunct faculty doesn't pay a lot.
No.
And I didn't have insurance, I didn't have anything, you know, and I had 2 kids to bring up. And Park Service, you'll recall I talked about those programs that came out of the Historic Preservation Act, which Park Service at various times, and people like or don't like, but this is what people call them, external programs, meaning they were outside of parks, external to parks, mm-hmm. and then internal was park programs, or outhouse programs was a little less complimentary. There's always been a testy relationship between the National Park Service and the programs that came out of the Historic Preservation Act. Part of it is because originally there was a new agency created, Historic Conservation Hookers, HCRS, Historic Conservation, you can Google it. But it was HCRS.
Oh, HCRS.
And we used to call this, and then it came in under Carter. And then it disappeared under Reagan. And so all those former hookers were absorbed into the National Park Service, as were the programs. Because it does say in the Act, National Park Service.
Right.
So they come in and line Park Service people look at these and go, they're taking money away from our parks. They're taking, those historians could be helping our parks. Why are they working on a tax act project? Or why are they helping this community? Why are they doing this? There was a contentious relationship, which in all honesty continues to this day. Mm-hmm. Now in Alaska, you'll recall Anilka and Angsa had passed. When I went in 1985, mm-hmm. we were birthing national parks.
Right.
You had national parks out there. I never forgot Harlan Hobbs, who was one of the real estate people who bought the land in Skagway.
Okay.
For the park. When the first superintendent went in, who was Huffman, he said, and I will quote it, they sent that poor son of a bitch up there without so much as a DI-1 or a pencil and told him to make a park. Now, a DI-1 was a purchase order.
Okay.
That's what we used to buy. You couldn't, to buy a pencil, you had to have a DI-1. They've long since gone to history. But I never forgot that. And so when I came in to the regional office at Anchorage, they had gotten these new programs to manage. And one of them was the Historic Preservation Fund grants program. Those grants did two things. One is it was the 80% funds that went to the State Historic Preservation Office. And then 10% of that had to go to certified local governments for their projects. And then anything else that would be put under the umbrella of HPF would go through there. So Senator Stevens wanted to fund something that was historic. Mm-hmm. He could earmark money in the Historic Preservation Fund to go to Alaska Data Center in Anchorage, mm-hmm. for example. He could put the money in and say, I want it to go there. This is how much goes there. And the Park Service, I did that paperwork. I made that happen. And they did not have someone doing that before.
Okay.
And so they advertised a part-time permanent, but it was permanent.
Right.
Got to get that permanent status. It was permanent to manage the HPF fund, the Historic Preservation Fund grants program. And I'll never forget, I walked in there my first day, and Bob Spooty hands me this, remember file trays that you used to get in and out boxes on your desk? And it's stacked about a foot and a half high with paper. And he said, here's this. And then he gave me this book, NPS 49, that was about 3 inches thick. And he said, and that's how you do it. Go at it. And don't screw it up, because apparently it had been screwed up at some point, and this is why they got the funds for a grants manager, and the state didn't get their money on time.
Right.
And Senator Stevens was rightly so not happy about that.
Right.
So I came on as the Historic Preservation Fund grants manager. And then the next year, through accretion of duties, it became a full-time position, mm-hmm. which I got. So then I started just teaching night classes at the university to fill in. Because, again, single mother, and I had a hockey player and a figure skater.
Oh, my.
And as another mother and I used to sit on the bench and watching our daughters skating, we said, we can't wait till they go to college. It'll be so much cheaper than skating. Competitive figure skating is very expensive.
Well, also a lot of time of, you know, watching hockey games and figure skating. I mean, they are...
Oh, yeah. 5 a.m., I'm at the rink.
Yeah.
Where are you at 5 a.m.? I'm at one of the rinks. When my daughter turned 16, I gave her a car, a AAA card, and a cell phone. You can get yourself to the rink at 5 a.m. because I still have been to get to a rink at 5 a.m. But anyway, so I was the grants manager, and then I'm looking at your...
So that was in what year?
87 to 89.
Okay.
And in 88, I became full-time.
Okay.
And then 89 to 92, I was the Historic Preservation Program Manager. And that was the NHL's National Register, Tax Act. I was also the Contracting Officer's Technical Representative, COTR, on grant on agreements. That's when I worked with UAF.
Right.
Because I was responsible for the Project Jukebox.
Right, okay.
And then, and the Alaska War Commemoration and Conference in the early 90s, mm-hmm. I was the Park Service representative to that team. And then from 92 to 95, I was concurrently with being regional historian, I was also the Historic Preservation Officer, which meant every park compliance action excuse me, went through me. And we would manage a couple hundred a year.
Wow. So how was being a Historic Preservation Officer different than like what Ted was doing as Head of Cultural Resources, where he was dealing with compliance?
Ted dealt primarily with archaeological compliance.
Okay.
And but myself, and then by then I had staff. My staff managed the files. In the Park Service, our compliance form was called a triple X form. They keep trying to change the name of it, but everybody still calls it the triple X.
But so your compliance was like historic building compliance?
Oh, and I also managed the paperwork for the archaeological compliance, but I would rely upon Ted or his staff for their expertise.
To do the actual work.
To do the actual work, or to make sure that the work being done was appropriate.
Right, okay.
And then, and it was 92 to 2004, I was supervisory historian. My title began as regional historian.
Mm-hmm.
I followed Bob Spoody as regional historian. And then with the 95 reorganization of the National Park Service, those regional titles went away. And so...
Why did you decide to become regional historian, or
it was,
apply for the
position? It was a promotion.
Mm-hmm.
And also I had to, it really was a decision to be made, because I loved project work, which is what you do as a GS 7 or 9, somewhat as an 11. At 11 you start supervising, and each of those is more money,
mm-hmm.
More autonomy. But regional historian came open, and so I had to make a decision. Did I want to be a pencil pusher? Did I want to do budgets? Did I want to spend my days supervising and doing performance appraisals and all the management stuff? Not leadership, because in my mind there's a huge difference between management and leadership.
Hmm.
And so it was all the management stuff. Did I want to do that instead of research and writing, which is what I went to graduate school for? So I had to make that decision. But on the other side, it was an opportunity for leadership. And leadership to me is having a vision of where our program should be going, of having... the ability to inspire others to move in a cohesive direction. At one point in my career, later on when I went to Santa Fe and I encountered an office that was not like the Alaska Regional Office and was going through a lot of changes, which quite honestly is why they hired me, to make those changes, is I had to say, it's not the job of the National Park Service. It's not our purpose to provide you with a job only doing what you want to do and only going where you want to go and only living where you want to live. The purpose of the National Park Service is to ensure that our parks are preserved so that when you visit it, your son visits it, your daughter's children visit it, and your great-grandchildren visit it, it's still the same. The experience and the story, and I'll back off on story, but the experience never changes.
Right.
The story will always evolve. There was a time when we didn't talk about slavery.
Right.
At Civil War sites. That evolves.
The interpretation
and changes in our understanding of who we are as a people changes. We often will realize when we say all people are created equal and we the people, who all people and we the people are changes all the time.
Right.
Remember, women didn't vote until
100 years ago.
100 years ago. I was going to say less than, but we're getting there. We're there. Native Americans didn't vote till 1924. Black Americans got the vote out of the Civil War, but Reconstruction and Jim Crow took it away.
Right.
We're constantly changing, and the story needs to develop too.
Right.
There's a lot of places where I never forgot. Here's the best example. I was at the Smithsonian looking at artwork. and there was this painting. And it's wagons coming through the Cumberland Gap mm-hmm. with people walking beside the wagon and riding on the wagon. And it's called The Pioneers and Their Wives. And I looked at that and I thought, the wives are staying at Holiday Inns at night?
Yeah.
They're not pioneers.
They were pioneers too.
Even Alaska pioneers. Used to have Alaska pioneers and then there was a women's organization mm-hmm. that was separate from it. Uh-uh.
Yeah.
No.
So anyway, I digress. Yeah, you just.
So I decided that I wanted to do that.
That it was okay to switch roles.
Yeah. And I also like to know stuff. I like to be in those meetings where you find out what the hell's going on.
Yeah.
You know? We used to say we're federal employees. It's like being a mushroom. We're fed a lot of poop and in the dark. but anyway. So I decided that that's what I wanted to do. And I also looked around and went, I don't want to work for any of those other people.
Yeah.
And I think by then, Ted had become chief. I don't remember if Leslie was still there. I liked working for Leslie.
Leslie Hart,
yeah. I did. She could. Some people found her very difficult. In working for her, I did not. I actually really liked working for Leslie.
So she was head of cultural resources?
Yeah, when I came on.
And historian fell under cultural resources?
Yes, cultural resources was history, archaeology, cultural anthropology, historic architecture, cultural landscapes. Did I leave somebody out?
Well, ethnology, but that's anthropology.
Part of cultural anthropology. Yeah. Yeah.
And subsistence is separate.
Subsistence is, that comes out of Anilka Angsa.
Okay. We won't go there.
Which I always say them together. Some is,
right.
You know. But yeah, that's out of Anilka Angsa.
Right. So why was, what was the feeling of why Leslie was difficult?
She was very tightly wound. And I always picture her with her half glasses halfway down her nose, with her sitting at a calculator, and her voice would come out. And actually, Susan Morton and I, who was the Susan I was talking mm-hmm. about, was archaeologist in the National Register programs. I was historian. And we were hired the same day. We got full time the same day. In fact, I have a picture of both of us on our first day at work. Our desks are on top of each other. They weren't even ready for us. And we're climbed up on top of those two big desks and did a picture. We called it the Day of the Short Girls. And Leslie called us Cindy. That was the combination of both our names. Susan and Sandy became Cindy. And she'd be in her office, and we'd hear, Cindy! We thought, oh, no, what did we do now? And she also would point a finger.
No.
That finger would just wag at you. But on the other hand, she also made sure I could do my job, and she was very supportive of what needed to be done. You know.
Yeah. So when you became the regional historian. Bob Spoody had left and you became. So what did need to be done, or what did you think needed to be done?
There was a lot of work in parks that needed to be done. And we needed to be working with parks to get that done and to figure out what that work was. The relationship between, now I'll speak to the relationship right. between regional offices and parks,
yeah.
is often a contentious one. Because the people in parks are there every day and they're on the ground. They know they think they know the resources better than anybody. They deal with the visitors. They deal with the totality of the park. You sit in a regional office in divisions, think of the word. Divisions. Okay. Hate that word. And you're primarily concerned with your area of interest, whether it's contracting or budget or cultural resources or natural resources, mm-hmm. Law enforcement. You're in your little cocoon. Mm-hmm. It's very, very stovepiped. And often the people in the regional offices are PhDs or are professionals, mm-hmm. right? Quote, I'm doing air quotes.
Yeah, quotes.
Same can be in parks. But the people in the regional office think they know better than the people in the parks. The people in the parks think they know better than the regional office. And everybody hates everybody in the Washington office. Because they're so removed from parks, they have no understanding of what we face out here in the field. Now, in Alaska, because, remember, we're birthing parks.
Right. A lot of them were created in 1980.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They don't have cultural resource staff. They don't have hardly any staff. What was it, Klondike? I think at one point when they think they have a lot of staff, they have 8 people.
Yeah.
Working in a park. And so, and plus, with Ted's absolute commitment that our role was there to support parks, that's where we were going. The other thing that happened was the 1995 reorganization of the National Park Service. Before the reorganization, there were 10 regions of the National Park Service. 5 of those regions were called super regions. What that meant was the regional office not only had responsibility for the national park units, and I'll use that meaning right. recreation areas, all of them, the whole panoply, the whole alphabet soup in that region. But they also had responsibility for those National Historic Preservation Act programs. And so they had staff that dealt only with state historic preservation offices. And at that time, they believed that if you were funded through the Historic Preservation Fund, you couldn't do any work
right.
for in a park. Or you could only work on the tax act. You could only work on this. You could only work.
And so Alaska was one of those super regions?
Alaska became, when we became a region, after being an area office, we were a super region.
Okay.
We were constantly fighting with the office in San Francisco, who still thought that they controlled us.
Because when Alaska was an area, San Francisco was
Yes, the super region.
Okay.
And I'm not sure, Frank Norris would know, of course, but I'm not sure when the 5 super regions was created.
Yeah.
So,
1995
comes the reorganization of the National Park Service. No more super regions. We went from 10 regions to 7.
Oh.
Alaska remained its own region. There was discussion about putting Alaska under San Francisco again.
I can't imagine.
One of our staff even made up T-shirts that said 180 degrees of management. It'd be all the way from Alaska to Guam to Hawaii.
Yeah.
You know, it would have been a huge region. But Alaska remained as it was a region.
Mm-hmm.
And the other regions, the boundaries change.
Right.
The other message of the reorganization was that did away with those titles of regional historian, regional this, regional that. It fully put forward that these central offices were there to serve parks. Some people call it the superintendent's revolt. And it truly was designed that, in fact, there was even a targets given to central offices. Our office, if I remember correctly, went from 225 permanent employees, and our target was 98.
Wow.
But it stopped at, I think, 118, 120 because of subsistence. We got subsistence responsibilities.
Right.
And so they went, oh, stop. We can't have that added on and still get rid of all these people. And cultural resources lost a huge amount of staff. The first to go were all the term employees. First temporary employees,
right.
Then term employees. Then permanent employees. And so Ted had the vision. And he'd always said, our purpose is to serve parks.
Right. Right.
So what Ted worked at was getting parks to hire the people who'd been in the regional
office.
That's
what I was going to say. The people who lost their job regionally, did they get sent out into the parks?
In Alaska, they did. Not in other regions.
Okay.
Because Ted thought it was important, and he worked with superintendents to get, and with the regional office. He gave up funding to move that money to the parks.
Yeah, that's what he was saying yesterday.
To pay for those people out there.
Right.
That did not happen in other regions.
Okay.
So
did that change your responsibilities as
yes,
a historian?
We were advisory. And so I was no longer regional historian, so we became supervisory historian. And in fact, I remember being at our last regional historians meeting under the chief historian in Washington, D.C. And I said, so what's our title now? And he said, well, Sandy, your title can be anything you want. And I said, then I want to be the queen of history. And one of our gay regional historians says, oh, sweetie, I've been that for years. And in fact, my goodbye poem that Ted wrote for me is called The Empress of History.
There you go.
Since I had the Russian background.
Right.
But we became supervisory.
If there were historians in the parks, such as Carl is currently at Skagway, you were their supervisor?
No, not at all.
Okay.
The superintendent was their supervisor. I supervised my staff, which was ever shrinking.
And you were supervisory historian in that you were in charge
and
of
we
all
were
the
senior,
projects?
Yeah, I did the same work I did before.
Okay.
Pretty much. It didn't change for us in Alaska because we always worked to support parks.
Right.
One of the differences that came with that was when I first started, the Alaska Regional Office, the president's budget is passed. This chunk of money goes to Department of Interior. Department of Interior gives this chunk of money to the National Park Service. The National Park Service then divides up that chunk of money. The Alaska Regional Office would get a chunk of money, and part of that chunk of money would go to cultural resources.
Right.
And in that chunk of money was project money, which is the lifeblood to the parks.
Right.
It's how they get stuff done. Well, parks would write, I can't even remember now what they were called, 10238s, which were their proposals for projects. And they would come into the regional office. And we would then sit in a smoke-filled room, not quite, and we'd go through the projects. And all the projects that wanted an administrative history or other history, I would look at. Ted or whoever was regional archaeologist after Ted became chief archaeologist, Gary Summers, would look at the archaeology projects, historic architecture.
Right.
Divvied
out.
We'd sit around the table. And then we'd go, okay, we have this much money. We have always had requests for 10 times money we got. How are we going to divide it up? Under Ted's leadership, we would make an effort to divide it among parks and disciplines.
Mm-hmm.
And we also worked closely with the parks, so we knew who really needed this place really needs to have this archaeological study done because they're going to put a visitor center in. We got to do the work. This place really needs it because we know new interpretive panels are going to go in and they need information.
Mm-hmm.
We tried to divide it up. There was also a little bit of archaeologists would look, oh, Denali, they're asking for an archaeology project for them to manage, and their cultural resource person is a historian. We're not giving her archaeology money. Supposed to be based on need.
Well, but in that example, would they say, well, we'll do the archaeology based out of the regional office?
If they had the money.
They couldn't use that project money.
No.
They could.
In the old days, we could, yes.
Okay.
So, okay, we could do it. We'll do it.
But in the new regime, you couldn't.
Well, after the 95 reorganization, a whole new way of doing funding comes in. And I forget how long it took, but they created this PMIS, Project right. Management Information System.
That's what they use now.
What it is supposed to do is to identify the needs and priorities of the National Park Service as a whole. So when I would go argue with budget, when I was in Washington as deputy associate for cultural, and parks were my responsibility, not so much external. I didn't have the right. external programs. I was parks. And I'd go to the comptroller and say, we really need money for submerged cultural resources. We've got all these sunken ships. We've got all this. We've got that. He'd look at PMIS and he'd say, well, there's not one project in here. Project request. Well, that's because the Submerged Cultural Resource Unit was doing all that work. So I got them to start putting in projects. The PMI projects through the parks, because only parks could put in for them, right. not regional offices. The money wasn't supposed to go to us.
Right. But so that's the example you gave of Denali, that if they wanted the archaeology, they didn't want it funded because it was a historian, but the regional office couldn't then do that project.
Right.
The money had to go to the park.
And after 90, after with PMIS, it didn't. The person in the regional office didn't decide who got the money.
Right.
You could make recommendations, mm-hmm. but you didn't decide it.
Okay.
It was determined by need and priority and funding availability.
But somebody
ideally.
Somebody decides need and priority.
It's supposed to be based on what's in the system.
So it's somehow an automated?
Yeah. That's how it's supposed to work. And you notice I'm saying supposed to. Because what happened is not everybody understands that. And so now looking at the national perspective, when I'd sit there, I found out that some parks only allowed cultural resources to put one project into PMIS. Well, they might need 10, but no, they could only put one in. Some parks only had one person who was allowed to enter things into PMIS, and you had to go through that person, a gatekeeper.
Right.
And then we found out that they were prioritizing based on what they thought they could get money for. If they knew there was going to be a lot of backlog cataloging money,
right.
well, let's put in backlog cataloging projects because there's money there. There's no money over here. So it really was not working that it truly reflected the needs and priorities of the service.
Right.
However, I will argue that it was more fair.
Than you guys sitting in a quote-unquote smoky room and deciding.
Yes. I mean, the example I'll give you, when I got to Santa Fe as the chief of cultural resources for the Intermountain region, which mm-hmm. was Montana to Texas, across to Arizona and up. So Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Texas, and Arizona, and Utah. I had a superintendent come to me and say, well, here, and I was asking, okay, what changes do you need? He says, well, I've had one of your archaeologists spend over $1 million of archaeology money in my park, and he didn't do one thing I needed done.
Wow.
It was his own interests. He was following his own research interest. And that was happening all over the service. PMIS was supposed to fix that.
Mm-hmm.
It was supposed to fix that. So.
So.
Anyway.
We got off onto that.
I get on tangents, I
That's
apologize.
That's okay. Where were we? So, when you became the historian in Anchorage for, I'm going to want to call you regional or supervisor.
Call it
historian
regional.
Or
call
or
it
whatever.
Regional historian, because that's what it is.
Did you feel you had some training and background from having worked with Bob Spoody before, or were you sort of dropped into it?
Probably some background from Bob being there, but we were very different kinds of managers and the world had changed.
Mm-hmm.
And priorities had changed. But I'd at least observed him doing it.
Mm-hmm.
probably my strongest influence was Ted.
Yeah.
I really modeled myself as a leader on Ted and seeing how he accomplished things. And then, you know, you just do it. You just figure out, I know this park needs that. How can I get that for them?
Mm-hmm.
How can I get it? How can we get this done?
Did you have any specific goals in mind when you went into the position? Or things you wanted to accomplish?
I don't know that I had any specific things. I know I wanted to do a lot more with Alaska Native groups than we had. There were stories that we weren't telling in our parks yet that needed to be told. Women's history. I also was very interested in getting cultural compliance to not be a big pain in the ass. It's supposed to be part of the planning process. And unfortunately, too often, it's the thing that comes in at the end where everybody's already decided. What I mean by that is I'll give you an example from another region. I had a park that had the old-fashioned entrance to the park. It still had the gateway across it and the little building where the ranger would come out and say, welcome to this park and here's your information, and if they had a fee, collect their fee. So times have changed, and we had a problem, this park had a problem, where the fee collector had on two occasions been attacked by a visitor.
Wow.
Because she had to come out of the little building mm-hmm. and go to their window. They couldn't pull up. There wasn't a window that you pulled up to. So there's no separation between herself and the visitor. And the second time, she was really hurt.
Wow.
The person, she had reached in and the person grabbed her and just started driving away, and she was dragged down the road.
Oh.
So park has a problem.
Right.
So law enforcement says, we have a safety issue here. We're tearing down that building, and we're building the brand new style.
Right.
Greet the visitor from inside the building. Cultural Resources says, you can't do that. This building is part of the National Historic Landmark. You can't tear it down. So we have a fight. Well, that's because they started thinking about it. They weren't asking the right question.
Mm-hmm.
The problem that needed to be solved was safety. Nobody's going to argue about that. So what should have happened, and ultimately did, is law enforcement and cultural resources together should put together a package that says, here's what we can do to make sure. Maybe we make an adjustment to the building. Maybe we do tear it down and build something compatible. Maybe we document it, tear it down. Maybe we don't. But what happened is everybody focused on, I want to tear it down.
And you're stopping me.
And you're stopping me. And we're not letting you tear it down. Instead of focusing on what the problem was, which was we have a safety issue. How do we solve it? And so my goal was to get compliance to the point where people work together rather than coming in late. A good example, the visitor center, there was going to be a new visitor center put in Seward.
Mm-hmm. Kenai Fjords.
For Kenai Fjords. Great project. So we sit down with planning and I say to them, and planning and construction guys, the planning guys, the construction guys, and us, sit down together, and we do a calendar. And I said, okay, visitor center needs to be done here. Okay, so we have that date. Let's back up. What are the
milestones.
Milestones, yes, thank you. And so it was, okay, we need to have this by then. We'd say, well, we need to have this by then. So we know we need to have this done. If we don't have it done then this moves. If you guys don't get the funding, like when they didn't get the funding when they thought they were going to get it, so that moved everything ahead. That changed what we did. Also, we need funding to do this work here.
Right.
Well, it ended up that because we all worked together, that project for Seward was one of the best things we ever did. The superintendent loved it, the park loved it, and the community loved it. Because we didn't just go in and do our archaeology. We did public meetings. We had Judy Kessler, yeah, who was a brilliant IT person, did all these, took the aerial photography and the old fire maps, put it all together, and we did maps and did a public meeting, and people brought in their own photographs and they identified buildings and places that were now gone, so it informed our archaeological survey. It was fabulous. It was, we learned so much,
right.
And they moved that visitor center I don't know how many times. And not just because of us, but because funding would change, the community would change, this would change, this changed, that changed. But we all worked together. And it was exciting. And so we all learned.
Right.
And so that was my goal for compliance. Because compliance was really, was viewed by construction and by most parks as that thing we have to do, a box we have to tick off, rather than understanding that it's part of the planning and it can inform you of what you're supposed to be preserving. Right. Anyway,
right.
So yeah,
yes.
There was a goal.
Okay. Let's kind of move into your connections with Klondike and some of the work that was done over there. Do you remember your first... going to Skagway?
Wow, I went so many times. I don't know if I remember the first. I'm trying to think if I went out there with Kate Lidfors. She might have been regional historian between Bob and I. I don't know if she was actually a regional historian or not. She was there and then left. And yeah, I guess she did come back as regional historian. So maybe she was after Bob. But for a short time,
there.
And then she left again. I just remember it was, I think the thing that struck me most, one, is how difficult it is to get there. Second, when you get there and you realize, the first time I went there, the little grocery store was the only commercial building that was outside of the historic district.
Wow.
And when you realize that Skagway is only, what, 4 streets wide and 10 streets long, maybe, then you understand why the people who lived there were so concerned about these plans the Park Service was doing. Like, no driving down Broadway? Well, it's the commercial center of the town.
Right.
Didn't want the streets paved? Park Service didn't want the streets paved? So it would retain that historic look. Well, that was ridiculous. That was ridiculous. And we found a pavement that I think actually it was used at Historic Williamsburg that sort of looked, gave the appearance of, but still you didn't have, I think as one local community person, well, when you get one of those visitors sliding down the street in her lime green pantsuit in the mud, maybe you'll want to have the street paved. So it was understanding that and how far away Dyea is and how very different Dyea is.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember you talked about the trip with taking Gary Summers out there and Carl taking us over to Dyea, Carl and Clay. And just that Clay was like worried about bears.
That's Clay Alderson, the superintendent.
Yeah, Clay Alderson, the superintendent, sorry. And we're going... But this place is washing away, you know. So I just remember that and the slide cemetery and wanting to know, like, Are these markers at all related to where people really are or not? What's real here and what's not? The Poland house was still standing the first time mm-hmm. I went, and it broke my heart when it went.
Yeah.
And I will always regret that we did not get the Poland house. It would have been such a contribution.
Yeah. Was it under consideration by the park?
Oh, yes. Park Service wanted it. Frank Norris writes a lot about it in the administrative history.
Right.
What I was told in the community was that the people who owned the Poland house thought the Park Service was offering peanuts. Mm. And somehow the local community, and not just regarding the Poland house, got the idea that Disney wanted to buy Skagway and make it a historical park. None of that is true. And that they were holding out for the millions that Disney was going to pay them.
Right.
Well, that was never, ever. There's no fact
right.
base for that whatsoever. But losing the Poland house really broke my heart. I think the other thing, thinking about Skagway and impressions from there, was how much the staff loved the place. They really did. Alaska staff are really like that. You know, a lot of park people love the parks they're in. They mm-hmm. really do. And that's why some people, we call it homesteading. When somebody stays in a park probably too long
mm-hmm.
or spends their whole career right. in one park. But I think a park staff needs to be a mix. You need some homesteaders who have that. Carl Gerke,
right.
who remembers everything that ever happened there. But you need the new ideas coming in, too. You need people to know the new story, to understand what's happening in the wider service, mm-hmm. because we are a service. Compliance was not a big issue at the park because we had the 11 building survey, and which was the historic structures reports that are needed for historic buildings before mm-hmm. you work on them. And that was done for Skagway. Also, the archaeology was done. So often we think about the building and we forget about the archaeology underneath.
Right.
The opposite we had at Brooks Camp, where I went out there, and everybody was so worried about, you know, getting under that 12 inches of dust to the archaeological, that they're redoing a historic building out there. I mean, didn't even think about the building. You worried so much about the archaeology.
Right.
Need to look at the totality.
So by the time you were involved, had all the buildings been restored? They'd all been purchased.
They'd all been purchased, but not all restored. And that, I guess I'll talk about that now, because I that is, for historic preservation thinking, it's so important.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really sure how it came about, and even looking at Frank's administrative history, I don't see it in there. But a decision was made early on that we would purchase, I think, 15 buildings, 15 or 16, mm-hmm. I forget. And we would restore the Moore House, the mascot, and the depot.
Mm-hmm.
And the depot would be used for administrative purposes. So it's the depot is more of adaptive reuse, but holding very strongly to the historic qualities of the building,
mm-hmm.
which it did beautifully, won awards.
Right.
The mascot would be for interpretive purposes and would be fully restored. In fact, one of the mannequins is supposed to be Frank Norris. And then the Moore House would be the same.
Mm-hmm.
It would be restored, and it tells different stories there. And then the other buildings, the exteriors, would be preserved, but we wrote off the interiors. Now, that is a questionable historic preservation decision.
Mm-hmm.
Because the interior still had historic fabric, whether it be wainscoting or wallpaper, they were there, but the decision was made to create a lease, a historic properties lease back program, which the proceeds of the lease backs would then be used to maintain the building's exteriors. It was the best decision we ever made.
So though, if somebody's leasing that building, they're not responsible for the painting in the exterior.
No.
That's all the Park Service retains that.
Oh, Park Service does that. And we also maintain rules about the buildings. For example, you can't live in the historic building. No cooking. Because you burn it down.
Right.
We also looked at what's being sold in the buildings. Mm-hmm. And there's no artifact sales.
Right.
In the buildings. And that was, I talked about Susan Morton, who was the archaeologist in the National Register programs. Susan worked very closely with law enforcement on several cases. In fact, she became a special agent for the National Park Service. And of concern was fossilized ivory. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing air quotes again. You can't see them. That's archaeological ivory.
Right.
It comes out of archaeological sites.
Right.
And the idea that none of it comes from federal lands, which then it would be protected by ARPA, the Archaeological Resource Protection Act, is ludicrous because of the amount of it being sold. Plus the huge issue it had in for Alaska Native communities. There was a huge bust that Susan was part of with U.S. Fish and Wildlife that was actually instigated by elders in a community who were doing everything they could to stop the looters from the buyers to come in, where they would get the young people in the community to go out and loot a site. And as they put it, they'd show up with their suitcases full of money and drugs. And Susan actually wrote up a wonderful pamphlet on the story of an Alaskan mask. And it was a mask that came out of, I want to say, the Barrow area. That sold at the community level, say, for $1,200. By the time it was sold for auction in New York, at Sotheby's, it sold for $112,000, or $112,000, you know. And so the people in the local community are getting peanuts.
Right.
Their heritage is being robbed. So she did a brochure, and we also looked at all of the sales in Skagway and told them no selling of fossilized ivory. They already knew they could not sell anything that was an artifact, which are sold in places because they'll say they don't come from federal lands. Right. And Susan was almost fired over that. There was such an uproar.
In Skagway?
There was one family in Skagway who said now they could not have children because they couldn't sell this. I mean, these are the things. Sue got another call from another salesperson. Susan, this is terrible. This is terrible. Mostly from Juno shops.
Mm-hmm.
But also there was complaints from Skagway. Now, these were the, I want to say they're people who own the businesses and were summer people.
Mm-hmm.
But I won't, I can't be sure. Complaints were made. Susan had to defend the brochure she had done. I remember the deputy regional director was bound and determined. And then it was a blessing from above. I want to say Walter Echohawk. It was one of the Echohawk brothers had a radio call-in show on public radio.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody from Skagway, one of the Skagway shops, let me say, not necessarily a community, but the Skagway shops, called in and said that the Park Service was limiting the ability of Alaska Native peoples to make money mining archaeological sites, air quotes again, but they used the term mining archaeological sites. And what did Mr. Echo Hawk think about this? And his response was, on our reservation, we know what to do to people who turn our heritage into keychains. Bless him. It saved her job.
Yeah.
After that, everybody shut up. So that was exciting.
Yeah.
That was exciting. So heading back, I digressed there. Heading back to the decision on the interiors of the buildings. Mm-hmm. I didn't really fully appreciate it until early 2000, maybe. I made a trip up to Dawson City and then floated the Yukon down to Eagle. And I saw what had happened to Parks Canada. Now, Parks Canada had undergone huge, they had, about the same time as we did, purchased all these historic buildings in Dawson City, as we had in Skagway. They made a different decision initially than we did. We decided, let the interiors go, bring in historic leasing. They went for full preservation and put millions of dollars into their buildings. But I'm up there, and it's years later, and the funding program for Parks Canada, or funding authorities for Parks Canada, had changed significantly. And they had changed in that no more did they get central funding from Ottawa. Each unit had to be self-sufficient. So when you went to Dawson City, that park had to pay for its own stuff. Do you want to pause?
You can finish this thought.
Okay. Then, had to pay for their own. So when you went there, if you wanted a brochure, it was a dollar. If you wanted this, it cost you something. And the historic buildings that weren't the reconstructed saloon and the main buildings that were being used for interpretive purposes, they were falling apart. Ceilings were collapsing. Wallpapers hanging off the walls. Because they had no funding source to preserve, to continue the preservation of the building and the maintenance of the buildings. Whereas the buildings in Skagway were maintained through the leasebacks.
Right.
Just in preparing for this, I looked online and I found that Dawson City has a new management plan from 2017. And in that management plan, they talk about commercial use of those buildings and leasing the buildings, which I hope is recent enough to save the buildings.
I hope so. Okay, we'll take a little pause here. Let's see. We are back from our little break. So back to Skagway and projects. Do you have a memory of particular projects you got involved with or made happen?
I really did more general stuff for Skagway.
Such as?
After Clay left, when Bruce, I think it was when
Bruce Noble,
Bruce Noble came in, he had me down for public meetings. There were a lot of issues between the community and the park. And complaints had come in, and Bruce really wanted to. Bruce was a fixer, a very, very nice man, and his wife is just lovely. And they just wanted to be part of the community, and they wanted the park to be part of the community. And also, the park had been there a while, so people were kind of used to the parkies being around, you know. And in all of Alaska, that was changing. I'm sure you remember from Yukon Charlie in Eagle how much they hated us.
Right. Well, at Skagway, I don't think they were particularly welcoming either, were they?
No, not at all. But things were changing. And I think a really good example of that is I remember having breakfast probably at Gertie's. And this young man comes and sits down, lives in the community, and starts talking to me about, he is running, he has a concession for horseback riding into the park. Very nice young man with his, I think I even met his wife and kids or something. Don't remember exactly. But I just have a general memory of just a lovely conversation. And he said to me, why do you treat Klondike? Why don't you treat Klondike like other national parks? And I said, well, what do you mean? And he says, well, we went on vacation. And we went to a national park. And the rangers are out, and they greet people, and they're there. You know, you see them. And I said, well, I thought people in Skagway didn't want us to wear uniforms. And he says, well, when I bring my guests out on horseback, he said, I think it would be wonderful if there were a Park Service ranger in uniform, so you know they're Park Service, greeting my guests and welcoming them to the park. That was astonishing to me.
Hmm.
I hadn't heard that side of
right.
it. And I thought, well, how much of this is left over from the days of Hoffman and Sims, who were not well-liked in that community? In fact, Hoffman surprised me because I started doing the administrative history. Bill Hannibal and I were going to do the administrative history. And we went down, Hoffman was superintendent at San Juan Islands. And so we went down to visit with him. And he's sitting at his desk talking about his time at Skagway, which from all accounts I had heard and read was very contentious. And he starts crying about how his time at Skagway was one of the best times of his life.
Wow.
So I'm going, where do these myths originate, and how do they influence how we see something and how we interpret something? Where are we missing the mark? We're not doing something right here.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other time I went down was to look at the Rapuzzi collection before we actually got it.
I was going to ask if you were involved in the Rapuzzi collection.
Not a lot. Tangentially, go down to look. I'd say when it was still all in those long buildings where you opened the door and it was floor-to-ceiling stuff. And in there would be I remember seeing the books from a mercantile or something, some store.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're going, oh my God, for a historian, here are the actual records of what people bought and sold and what they paid for it and how much of this they bought and how much of that. Very important. Next to a 1950s Electrolux vacuum cleaner. But really, Gene Swearingen Rodeck is the person who had the most to do with that, with Teresa Tebow.
Mm-hmm.
When it finally happened. That was so long. I was so worried it was going to go the way of the Pullen House.
Yeah.
That it would just be lost. Because there's too much valuable information there and lovely things.
They had to sort of do salvage curation, like you do salvage archaeology, I think.
Yes, yes. It seems to me they rented like the gym in an old school or something, some big space to set
it
up.
But you say they couldn't keep everything. They had to prioritize.
Exactly.
And
you have to go by, every park should have a collections
management plan.
Yeah. Thank you. So my trips to Skagway ended up being a lot of fixing or helping the park fix.
So did you get involved in any staff issues, if there were problems amongst the staff, or that was left to the
That was left to the park. I do remember, though, when Carl was hired. Bless you, Carl. I love you. But he was hired as a historian, and he's not a historian.
Right.
He's an archaeologist.
He's trained as an archaeologist.
He's an archaeologist. And I just remember yammering at Ted about that. You've got a historical park and no historian in the park. This makes no sense to me. It's not an archaeological park. The archaeology is important, and Carl should absolutely be there. But they also should have had a Frank Norris or someone mm-hmm. else on staff. They needed a historian on staff.
Do you know what happened as to why it transpired that way? That they started with a historian and not an archaeologist?
They started with an archaeologist.
I mean, why they didn't have an archaeologist position. They had a historian position.
Right. And then they hired Carl and qualified him as a
right.
historian. I'm sure that was an influence from Ted and Paul Gleason. Now, Paul Gleason was still going down to Skagway due to a lot of the archaeology there.
Under the buildings.
Yeah, under the buildings. And in the lots at the Moore House, I think.
Mm-hmm.
They were forever digging up.
Yeah.
Toilets. Outhouses. Our archaeologists yes. love outhouses.
Right.
Any conversation with archaeologists always ends up talking about poop.
Well, then, because Carl had already done a lot of the Dai archaeology and the trail archaeology, I think that was sort of ongoing, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So much of it, I mean, you watch the transition. Again, it's that transition from central offices having control over parks. When Dave Snow first went there as historic mm-hmm. architect, he worked for Denver Service Center.
Right.
And he didn't want to work for the regional office. And he didn't want to have to move to Anchorage, I don't think,
right.
If I recall right. The archaeology was all being managed by the Denver Service Center.
Right, Kathy.
Kathy Spoody, Kathy right. Blee at the time. And then even historic reports, the administrative history, why we had to do it in-house when finally Book of the Month Frank... finish the administrative history was because Denver Service Center took the money, spent it all, and never did anything. And I remember going down to Denver and chasing that historian around the building. He was jumping into elevators mm-hmm. to avoid me because I wanted to know where our project was. We'd sent them money, a lot of money, and got nothing. And so... a lot of my work was to make sure stuff that was supposed to be done was actually getting done.
Mm-hmm.
But also that change from central offices controlling parks, I would argue it never was a good model. Never.
Right.
We should all, and then we went to, we created teams. What nonsense. They called them teams, but everybody operated the same way they always did. They were not teams.
You mentioned about things not getting done. That seems to be a pattern in the Park Service, that money gets thrown at something and there isn't necessarily a product, whether it's internal or a contract. How can that happen? How is there not checks and balances or something? I don't know what the word is.
Good management. They're supposed to be.
In some place else, if you give in money and you don't do it, you're fired.
Exactly. As someone once said, you're a federal employee. It takes an act of Congress to fire you. Which is not true, because I have actually fired people. It just takes a lot of time, effort, and work.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to have a solicitor's office who supports you. It's not easy. The other thing is, it's rarely one person. As I said, for example, with Seal Islands, I was the third, fourth, or fifth person to work on that mm-hmm. project. I wrote the Yukon River Lifeways nomination. And I was at least the second, if not third, person to work on that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess oversight. There's, I mean, all that money that didn't get a product. How is that possible?
What happens is, first of all, it's 1 year money.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't get the money till maybe May, and it has to be spent by October 1st.
Right.
So you hire a summer seasonal to do the project, and it's impossible for that project to get done over one summer season. And so they do their work on it, and then it gets picked up by the next summer seasonal. Because even if the project is a continuing project, you don't get the second year's money October 1st. It doesn't come until there's, you've seen it, there's an appropriate, first the budget has to pass Congress and the mm-hmm. president has to sign it. Good luck with that.
Right.
We once traced funding when I was in the Washington office. And here's how it works. A park program decides they have a need. So they write up their PMIS statement for their need. That gets fed into the Washington, their region. Their region then prioritizes all the needs from all the parks. And they're prioritizing based upon where they think there might be money, if there's an initiative coming down the road that's going to have money thrown at it. Whoop! Does it look like we're going to get money for backlog cataloging? Does it look like we're going to get money for deferred maintenance? If we get deferred maintenance money, then that means we have to have the compliance done to get the deferred maintenance done. So things get prioritized. That priority then goes to Washington. And then the National Park Service takes all of those seven regions' priorities and makes a single priority that then goes to the Secretary of Interior. The Secretary of Interior looks at Park Service and Fish, BLM, and says, BIA, okay, here's what we're going to put forward to the president because we're all the executive branch.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, those three branches of government.
Right.
We're the executive branch. So we're going to feed all this into the president's budget. 90% of what's in the president's budget didn't start anywhere
right.
here. So a park has maybe 10% chance for their little project to make it all the way up to the president's budget. Then the president's budget goes to Congress where it's dead on arrival. No matter who the president is
right.
and who the Congress is. And then it starts. Then they start looking at it. Then this initiative comes, that initiative comes. They're not going to give money to this anymore. They're going to give money to that. The Historic Preservation Fund every year has been recommended for zero funding.
Right.
That's what funds all the state historic preservation
right.
offices. It usually gets put back in somewhere along the
but
line.
But because that budget process takes so long, you don't get the money to do these.
It could be 10 years
yeah.
before you get your money.
But the fact that...
Then you finally get the money, and you're going to put it... So what do you do with it? You don't get it until May. So, well, let's put it in a cooperative agreement. Let's put it in a CESU. Those are excellent.
Cooperative park study units?
Yeah.
Things?
Yeah. Cooperative education study units they are now.
Yeah, right.
Because you could put money into those pretty quickly because they've already been through the competitive process.
Right.
So we give University of Alaska Fairbanks Oral History Program money to do a project for us. And we give it to them. And then the person that they were going to have do the project leaves. But that money's good for, once it's in
five
the project,
years, yeah.
but it's good for up to five,
right.
up to 5 years if it's been written right in the first place. If the person writing the project didn't know what they were doing, they might have only written it for 1 or 2 years, and now we're screwed. And so that's what happens. A lot of times you have the university. Your agreement is actually with the university, not the
right.
individual professor.
Right.
So what if they have a clunker individual professor who has all sorts of projects going on? You can't believe the excuses I have heard.
You have a favorite?
Oh, well, probably the best one was she died.
Oh, well.
Well, okay, she's taken the money for 3 years. We have nothing. The university is responsible for the project. Where's the project? Oh, well, all her notes and stuff are in her garage, and her husband doesn't know where they are. And so they're all thrown out because she died.
And so what does the Park Service do?
What do we do?
You've spent the money and you have no projects, so... Yeah, what?
You're stuck.
So then you have to find
the money all over again.
Yeah, it seemed that not.
And then contractors. Lord, save me from contractors. Because at least in a cooperative agreement, you're working closely with
right. That
professor or that NGO, non-governmental organization.
Right.
And usually you're working together to get it done.
Right.
Contractor. You give them the money, they go away. Maybe you get something, maybe you don't.
Yeah, it just seems like there should be some way to make it happen. Well, maybe when you were the historian, did you have ways to get those things
done? I'd stay on them. I'd be calling those people and annoying them all the time and saying, and writing your agreement properly or your contract properly with benchmarks that people are held to. But the problem with report writing is the benchmarks are squiggly.
Yeah.
I had one contractor who wasn't producing. Oh, my car broke down, my dog died, you know, my kid ate the paper. And so finally I got on it and got contracting. We wrote a letter. We said, you will produce by then. She then went to the regional director and said I was being mean to her.
Mm-hmm.
And she cried, and he felt sorry for her. And I was in trouble. There's so many fingers in
right.
the pot. It's not one person managing it. And it's not like when you have a contract for 20 widgets.
Right.
Everybody knows when those 20 widgets are made, and there they are. When it's a report.
So do you feel it, as supervisory historian, that you helped get some things done that hadn't been done?
Absolutely. One would be the boundary review for Klondike Gold Rush, for Skagway.
Mm-hmm.
It's two NHLs, the Chilkoot Trail and the White Pass,
mm-hmm.
are two different National Historic Landmarks. We did the boundary review, got it done, and we sent it to Washington. And we heard nothing. 10 years later.
Oh my God.
I'm calling and saying, I've got a congressional. I need this done. This community. I've got the White Pass Railroad. For some reason, they hated being part of the National Historic Landmark. Finally, I said to the guy, you know, nobody rides your train except it's historic. Why aren't you bragging about being a National Historic Landmark?
Yeah.
Go figure. Well, and then you'll tell us what to do. Am I telling you what to do now? No. So it was a lot of trying to get people to understand and value what they had. To talk about the boundary review for Klondike Gold Rush. I'm probably being indiscreet, but I'll be it anyway, because I love the story. So, we finally get the boundary review for Chilkoot Trail and White Pass blasted out. But it has to go, it must be sent to your congressional delegation. State Historic Preservation Office. I don't know. There's a list. Well, Washington sends that. Not us. Not the regional office. I was regional historian at the time. So we get a new regional director. Jack Moorhead. Lovely man. But we had heard before he came that he hated cultural resource people. He thought we were all royal pains. I had not met him. So I'm in Washington, D.C. at a meeting. And the associate for cultural resources for the National Park Service pulls me out of this meeting and tells me that Don Young is livid over the boundary review for the National Historic Landmark for Chilkoot Trail and White Pass. And he's really livid over the letter that I had drafted, but the director had signed, back to him. So I should back up. Boundary review goes through. Don Young, Congressman Young, sees this, and he misunderstands what it is. I think, I'm not certain, but I think he was confusing the boundaries of the park with the boundaries of the landmark. The landmark will be different than the boundaries of the park. Remember, the park has boundaries over what we manage. Landmarks, we only administer the program. So he sends a letter to the director, a what the hell's going on letter to the director, which of course gets filtered back down. The director doesn't write letters.
Right.
People write them for him. So it comes down to the regional director, who sends it to Ted, who sends it to me. So we have this new regional director who doesn't like cultural resources, I've heard. I haven't met him yet. And so I write a very long letter with a lot of explanation in it that I assume will be removed by people up the line, but I want our new regional director to understand. And so I write the letter that explains this is a National Historic Landmark. This is what a National Historic Landmark is. It was designated in 1963. It's not a new designation. It's defining the boundaries. It has nothing to do with the park boundaries. And in his letter, he had said, just because something's old doesn't mean it's important. So I said, well, we can disagree on what's historic and what is not. I looked to the congressional record for when Klondike Gold Rush was made a park to determine the historic qualities of Skagway. And I quoted him back to him. I thought that would all be taken out. It wasn't.
Uh-huh.
But it did inform Jack Moorhead about what it was we did, what it meant, and what it didn't mean. So I'm in Washington, I get pulled out of this meeting, and it says, Don Young is livid. Your letter, you're going to be fired. You know, we're going to take care of this from here now. So I thought, oh, they'll just screw it up even worse. We don't want Washington solving our problem, and it's our congressman. So I called Ted. And this is before cell phones. So I'm calling Ted. And I said, Ted, blah, blah, this is what's happening. He says, let me get with Moorhead and figure this out. So then he says, I said, okay. I said, I'm going over to the Smithsonian. Should I still go? And he says, yeah, just call me from there. So I'm calling him from payphones. And we're going back and forth. And so Ted says, okay, I've talked to Moorhead, you know, he's going to talk to Washington, blah, 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 just, you're out of it now. So I go back to my hotel, and it's like 11 o'clock at night, and I'm in bed, and my phone rings in my hotel room. And I answer the phone, and this voice says, Sandy, this is Jack Moorhead, the new regional director.
Uh-oh.
And honest to God, I said, am I fired? And he said, no! That was a great letter.
Oh.
And he said, and thank you for the warning. We will take it from here. And we don't want Washington office having anything to do with this. This is our issue. And it got all resolved. It got all taken care of. But but that was Skagway.
That was
everything you did. People went crazy over it.
Yeah, Skagway was a tricky place, it sounds like.
Yes. very tricky. And as I said before, when you go to that town and you walk down the street and you look, you realize why it is. Because the park and the community are pretty much the same thing.
Yeah, and that's unusual. Are there other parks like that?
I can't think of one. Where maybe on the East Coast, maybe, no, because even I've been to like Gettysburg is outside of the town
and
of Gettysburg.
I haven't been to Williamsburg.
Well, Williamsburg is not a park, Park Service. I can't think of anywhere else.
Where your downtown is a national park.
Where everything is the park.
Yeah.
And it they're so overlaid. Yeah. On top of each other and have to be. And of course you have this small community. I think that was even before the road went in. So it's very isolated.
Yeah. Well, you had mentioned that, you know, in the early days, the relationship with the park and the community and those first superintendents, Dick Sims, you sort of hinted was controversial.
Well, people in the community told me that, and Dick Sims sort of said, he just gave up. He did paint the buildings. Because the Park Service came in and everybody thinks tomorrow it'll be a beautiful national park, right? And everything will be done tomorrow. Well, it's not going to be. Plus, they understood they needed to do archaeology under the buildings.
They had to buy the buildings.
Buy the buildings. So everything's bought.
Right.
You get a superintendent in who only had one staff, and they raise the buildings up, and there's all these people come in from other places. Mm-hmm. Everybody's outsiders. Everybody who works at the park are outsiders. Frank, in his administrative history, talks about they couldn't even get SCA, Student Conservation Association, hires because nobody wanted to work for the crappy wages we pay.
Right.
So here's all these outsiders coming into your town. And all these buildings just get jacked up, and there's people crawling around under them, and people digging up outhouses. But what are they doing?
Right.
It looks like hell.
Right, and they're telling you that your town is historical, and it's just where you live.
Exactly. It's your home.
Yeah.
And so the first thing Huffman does when he comes in, or I'm sorry, Sims, is he paints the buildings. And our historic architects are outraged. And he said, people in the community loved it because something was happening.
Yeah, it made it look pretty.
It made it look pretty. And even if it wasn't the right color, you're going to paint over it anyway. What does it matter? He did something visible.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like when you watch those shows on TV, you know, Flip or Flop or whatever.
Oh, yeah, the house flipping.
Yeah, and they have to do the plumbing and the electrical. And they said, we're putting tens of thousands of dollars into this that won't show. And that's what we did at Skagway. We put tens of thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars into Skagway and nothing showed. So Huffman did that. But I think it was too isolated for him. He was not happy there. Mm-hmm. He didn't sit and cry about how he missed Skagway.
You mean Sims?
Like Sims.
Yeah,
like Huffman did. And people in town said, oh, we'd just see him sitting in his car reading a book.
Yeah.
You know, what they were saying was, what's happening?
Yeah. Why are you spending all this money and nothing's happening?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. At least he painted the buildings.
Yeah.
But I think they were too much outsiders, and both were at the ends of their careers where they might have run out of gas.
Mm-hmm.
Both, I think, got called into the regional office after that, which we had an old saying in the Park Service, superintendents misbehave, they end up in the regional office.
Yeah.
And in fact, when we were putting staff from regional offices into parks, parks would say, we don't want regional office rejects.
Yeah. another project I think you were involved with was the White Pass Historical Resource Study, the Wild and Discouraging
Mess. Julie Johnson did.
Right.
Yes.
You want to talk about that?
Oh, yes. I love that project. Really, a lot of it stemmed out of the work we did in Seward, where we saw how much the community responded to the work we were doing. And up until that time, if you've ever seen like a library of Park Service reports, They were a white page with a green stripe mm-hmm. across the, and it had the name of the park on it. And they were, for the most part, deadly dull. No pictures. They weren't, they might have been good history, but they certainly weren't interesting to read. So it came time to do the administrative history of Kenai Fjords. And Linda Cook did it. And we said, no, we're doing something people want to read. And I had the superintendent call me and say, it's your fault. I said, what's my fault? Ann Castellina was the superintendent. I said, what's my fault, Ann? She said, I didn't get any sleep last night because I started reading our administrative history, A Stern and Rockbound Coast. Yeah. We actually named it things that that were interesting.
Right.
And she said, and I couldn't stop. I was up all night. I read it all cover to cover. She said, I love it. We're going to sell it in the bookstore. Ha! Huh? Wow. What about that? And I had people come to me and say, you can't put pictures in those. I said, show me the rule that says I can't. People are always telling you can't do stuff. And then when you say, well, show me where in law or policy it says I can't do that. Where does it say in our management policies that I can't put a picture in here or print color?
Right.
Hey, well, it's not there. So when it came time to do the project for Skagway, I thought, you know, this is our healing time, right? We're supposed to be getting along with this community. Let's give them something the same way we did Seward. And Julie Johnson had been the director of Anchorage Historic Properties. And she had written something, I don't remember what it was, that I had read and really liked. And so I made a point of meeting her. Plus, when we still did external programs, we did a lot with communities and stuff. And I think I'd worked with her on the Tax Act project for the Fourth Avenue Theater mm-hmm. in Anchorage, which was a nightmare. I hear it's going to disappear now. But anyway, Julie just had a way of writing that was engaging and personal. And so we had the project coming up. And we actually did it through Alaska Association for Historic Preservation. Mm-hmm. We entered into a cooperative agreement with them. And then recommended that they hire Julie Johnson to do the project.
Mm-hmm.
And she did. And as part of the agreement, we also provided her office space and access to Xerox machines and computers and mm-hmm. stuff. So there's a method to this madness. Remember, people don't finish projects?
Right.
Well, if they're sitting right there, they do finish them. And when you help them make part of the agreement, the things that they need to get it done,
mm-hmm.
they get it done. And also by sitting right there with all of us, she got excited about parks and she got to understand parks more than if she just sat by herself either at Anchorage Historic Properties. She actually quit working for them.
Yeah.
They got a new director. She resigned. She became part of the Park Service family. And she did a fabulous job. I love what she wrote.
It's a really good, why we call it book, but report.
Yeah, it's a book.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful book.
Do you know what the decision was about why that study needed to be done?
Because the park didn't have one.
They didn't have a White Pass unit.
Yeah.
Study.
And they didn't know how to manage the White Pass. They weren't managing the White Pass. It was managed by default.
Mm-hmm.
Since nobody went there, it wasn't like the Choco Trail.
Right.
They really didn't have to manage it. But if there were resources in there, they really needed to know what those resources were, and they needed to make informed decisions about how to manage mm-hmm. them. And the park knew that.
And so did that decision to do that study come from the park, or that came from you?
Both of us.
Okay.
Both of us. You're talking about what the park needs were.
Mm-hmm. And they still don't really manage that
no.
unit.
There's not active management in the unit, but at least they know what's there, and they and I think they do they might do survey to check on stuff.
Yeah, probably.
So, and especially if things are archaeological or have become archaeological, really all you need to know is that nobody's messing with it.
Right. Well, and it is more difficult to access those slots.
Absolutely. It's difficult to access. The railroad goes up there, but nobody gets off
right.
along the way. You know, it's they can manage it the way they do, but they need to know what they've made informed decisions about how to manage mm-hmm. that unit.
At the time, were there discussions about doing more with that area and trails
yeah,
and things?
There was discussion of should there be a trail? Should there be hiking? Should there be more activity in there? But I don't think the park has the staff or the resources to be able to manage
mm-hmm.
another unit like that.
Right.
You know, if they went back to the days when, well, they never had the staff they needed there.
Mm-hmm.
But if they were fully staffed to their needs, they might be able to do it. It'd be a fabulous experience.
Yeah. I mean, I learned a lot reading that book.
Yeah.
You hear about the Chilkoot. I didn't know anything about the White Pass.
Exactly. So, you just think of it as the train route.
Yeah.
But it wasn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but then Carl had also mentioned this history of historic preservation in Skagway. Was that another report book
yes.
thing?
Yes. And that was, again, looking at where I talked about the preservation decisions made to lease back the buildings, to let the interiors go. Was that a good decision or not? Mm-hmm. Compare it to Parks Canada at Dawson City.
So was that a report that got done, the history of...
You know, I don't know whatever happened with that. I think I left.
Okay.
And when you leave, your babies don't get always taken care of.
Okay.
I truly don't remember what happened to that.
Okay. But that was something you were working on.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So when did you leave the Alaska Park Service?
I left in 2004.
Okay. And you went to Washington, D.C.?
No, oh. Then I went, I was Assistant Regional Director for the Intermountain Region
okay.
for Cultural Resources.
Okay.
And so I went, I was in Santa Fe,
mm-hmm.
which when there were 10 regions, Santa Fe was a regional office.
Right.
We have that lovely building there. The old Santa Fe Trail building.
Oh.
And so I went to Santa Fe for the first 2 years, and then because they had taken the position of Chief of Cultural Resources and made it an Assistant Regional Director, they then moved me to Denver, so I'd be with the rest of the directorate.
Mm-hmm. What was behind your decision to leave Alaska?
Couple things. I had remarried, and it was a terrible marriage, and I'd gotten divorced. My kids were now grown, and I didn't have to stay for them to be in school. Ben was off playing hockey in Montana, and Jennifer was ready to graduate college and was ready to move on. And I had been through a one-year leadership program, like future leaders or whatever. That wasn't Park Service. It was government-wide.
Mm-hmm.
And I just figured it was time for my career. The other part of that decision was people were leaving and not being replaced. There was so much attrition
mm-hmm.
in the office. And so, like, I can't remember when Gary Summers, the regional archaeologist after mm-hmm. Ted left, but Ted never was allowed to hire another regional archaeologist. Just if somebody left, it was just a hole not filled.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of looked and thought, if Ted leaves, they won't fill his position. I'll end up doing the job and not getting paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not, but I did a lot of acting
mm-hmm.
in my career. Sometimes call it an Academy Award career. And I thought, and I was just ready. And as a historian of the American West, the idea of going to Intermountain region and having that Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, that area being my area of responsibility was just exciting. So I went from what Alaska has 15 parks to 91 parks with responsibility for. And
were you recruited for the position? Or you
yes.
Just, yeah.
I was asked to apply.
Right.
I was not guaranteed.
No.
But I was asked to apply. The new regional director in Intermountain Region was Steve Martin, who'd been superintendent of Gates and Yukon-Charlee, and then he'd been
Denali.
Superintendent at Denali. And there were other people in there. By then, I was known.
Right.
And so I'd done an acting as assistant superintendent at Joshua Tree National Park, which I loved. And I often think I should have just stayed there. But, you know, woulda, shoulda, coulda.
Right.
And besides, when you look at decisions of things you didn't do, you only think of the rosy way it would have worked out. You
right.
don't think of the bad parts that right. might have happened there. So I was ready to do something with my life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to Intermountain Region. One other thing I'll say about Skagway before we leave there.
Mm-hmm.
One of my concurrent duties from 92 on was, or was it 95 till I left in 2004, was the Indian Self-Governance, Indian Self-Determination Act was passed, and part of that was Indian Self-Governance. And part of Indian Self-Governance was that tribes that had, and I'll use tribe in the legal sense, because in Alaska we know there weren't tribal people, but they get the designation tribe so that they qualify legally for all sorts of Indian benefits. Tribes who had an affiliation, that's not the right word, but you'll think of it, to a national park could... I know you're thinking of the word, too.
Traditionally associated people.
Traditionally associated, sort of like with subsistence.
Right.
They could, I want to say affinity, but that's not right either. They could propose to take over aspects of park operations. And this really got going in the Clinton administration. The Department of Interior during the Clinton administration was very open to this concept. So under Indian Self-Governance, actually, so subsistence was coming in, Indian Self-Governance was coming in, a realization that we really needed to not be islands, but we needed to be part of communities. And that in Alaska, when the Alaska parks were created, remember they're very new, they didn't kick out all the indigenous peoples as other places had.
Right.
And not just indigenous peoples, but local communities just kick them out. Shenandoah suffered from that. So the regional director created an Alaska Native Issues team. And I was asked to chair that team. I was asked to chair it because of my educational background in my writing and my studies. Also because I had managed the tribal grants program.
Mm-hmm.
So I had worked a lot with Alaska Native peoples before. See, the 95 reorganization took all those programs and pulled them back to Washington.
Right.
Nothing that I ever thought was a good idea. They were our entree to communities and how we worked with communities, but I won't get on that tangent. And so under Indian Self-Governance, my team had negotiated the first agreement under Indian Self-Governance in the Department of Interior. and that was with Coeric in out of
Nome.
And so whenever a tribal entity would document its affiliation and then want to meet with a park, I would lead that negotiation. I would assist the park and lead that negotiation. And it was even nationwide, not left to individual superintendents, because we had to act as a service. Because if Superintendent A agrees to something, then every other superintendent would have to agree to the same thing. And so I worked also very closely with Barry Roth, who was the Department of Interior solicitor, who was managing Indian self-governance for Interior, because Interior wanted to be sure we were consistent. So I managed several negotiations. Sitka was one, and Klondike was one. And the corporation out of Juneau.
Gold Belt, no?
No.
Oh, Sealaska.
Sealaska. Wanted to take over management of Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park. And that's usually where negotiations began. Mm-hmm. The tribal entity would come in and say, we want your whole budget and we want your whole park. You go on your way and we'll take over. Mm-hmm. And that's never where it ends up, because that just that for many reasons will not work. And so I went down to Skagway for those negotiations. And they weren't very long negotiations, because Sealaska looked at the budget for Klondike Gold Rush and said, you do all of this for this amount of money? And we said, yes. And they said, don't you get like so much money per person on the cruise ships? We said, no, we don't get anything. And they went, oh, huh, we're not interested. They thought that we got, you know, like so much per person who got off the cruise ships, which we do not.
Which is an interesting thought, that why not? But maybe that's a different...
That's a whole different thing. I'm not going anywhere near that one. So that was a short-lived negotiation.
Now, were there
that was another time I was down there.
Are there other parks in Alaska where that native self-determination has taken into effect, or are they helping operate the parks?
I'm not certain what has happened in Sitka.
Okay, that would
something
be a good example.
May have happened after I left the service, because they had their own issues there.
Right. But that's a good example that it could have happened there.
I don't know if anything ultimately happened in Sitka or not. The only agreement I know of that works is at Voyagers. Is it Voyagers at International Falls? Under Tim Cochran, who had been cultural... anthropologist in Anchorage. He entered into and has maintained for many years, he's retired now though, so I don't know the status of it, an agreement with the local band to, they do all the maintenance at the park.
Okay. So sort of back to the...
So that was another thing I did at Skagway.
Well, no, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I did not know about that.
Yeah. It was short-lived. We offered a position. You know, we could hire someone that, if they had someone going to college, you know, native. And they looked at what we paid and were not in the least interested.
Yeah. Did you have anything to do with any of the work on the Chilkoot? Or that was more archaeology?
No, that's all. That was pure archaeology.
All the history part had already been done?
Yeah. The history, you know, there was a trail, people climbed it, there's the picture that everybody sees. But the rest of it was archaeology.
Yeah.
And so thank God I never had to climb the trail. No hiking for me.
No hiking for you.
No. And Dai, I would have loved to have seen something happen for Dai. There's a wonderful story to be told there. There's not much physical remains, of course.
But why was nothing more done?
Well, it's washing away. I don't know if they ever moved that bridge. when I found out, they said, oh, you know, because of the way the bridge is situated, it causes the flow to come into mm-hmm. Dyea. And I said, well, you know, they should change the bridge. And well, but, you know, it had been 20 years. So I don't know if anything's happened in the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. But I used to think about Dyea a lot, as that really is part of the story not being told.
Right.
Or could be told even more than it is. There's always something you can do at a park, but Klondike, I think they do tell a great story there. The people are really passionate. They're there forever.
Yeah. Well, it's harder to tell the story when there isn't the physical evidence. Like you say, Dyea, there's not much there.
Absolutely. I used to do a talk on historic preservation in Alaska, and I would always begin it with a slide of the iconic red mining buildings with the white frame on them. Everybody would say, oh, that's Kennecott. And I'd say, no, it's not. It was, now I've forgotten the name, some other island where the same company, Kennecott Company, had built mining. But it had all been demolished, so nobody remembers it. Even I don't remember the name of the island right now. And that's when you lose those physical manifestations of the past, you lose the story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, doing documentation, take a picture, write the history. Well, it's not really the same. Not everything is worthy of preservation or able to preserve. Mm-hmm. But I do like the philosophy that we did at Kennecott. And that was really Steve Peterson who really hammered it home. Which he said, let's just put roofs on the building, because that gives us a 50-year fix. Because what we say is impossible today, oh, never. People will never there. This will never happen. Well, 10 years from now, it may not be never.
Mm-hmm.
10 years from now, the store is our visitor center right out there. You know, people in McCarthy don't shoot at us anymore. You know, things change. And so what you want to do in the work you're doing is not preclude other preservation options from the future. And so, again, that's why the history of historic preservation is important, is to look at those preservation decisions. You know, when we let the interiors go, we precluded preservation options that might have kept those interiors intact. But we might have lost the whole building, too.
Right.
And so you have to make those decisions. Historic preservation now, when I talk with students just coming out of preservation schools now, how they put it is, we don't want to be the paint police anymore. That we've spent so much time with the Secretary's standards, worried about a sconce, worried about wainscoting and the color of the paint, that we have looked at historic buildings as if they're all museums where you talk in hushed tones and nothing can ever change in them. And they're not living parts of the community. And remember where I began this. Historic preservation is local.
Mm-hmm.
If a local community doesn't care about it, kiss it goodbye. And so you need to meld that together. And so there's a real movement in historic preservation to get away from this idea of being the paint police. And what do we need to do that while animals evolve and change over time, so do buildings. But we must allow them to change and evolve over time so you don't lose the nature
right
of the building. You know, and it's hard. It's
yeah
hard to do. But we have, I think we need to go there. Because even museums anymore, what museum survives anymore where it's a place where you just go in and you speak in hushed tones and you look at 1,000 things in a case and all it says is bowl.
Right.
I mean, that drove me crazy. I find some museums to be the most boring places in the world because it says bowl 1850, bowl 1870, you know. Right. Well, so what? What was in the bowl?
You need to put it in context.
Put it in context. What's its story?
Right.
I remember when Ted first gave me an archaeological overview and assessment. It might have been for Bering Land Bridge, but I'm not sure. It was one of those parks, North Parks, archaeological parks, right? Air quotes again. And he said, there's something wrong with this report, but I can't grasp it. Would you read it for me and tell me what you think? And so I read it, and I went back, and I said, so was it cold? Did people live in houses? Or they said, there's no people in here. You've described all these points and little pieces of things, you know, 1,000 pictures of things that, you know, is somebody either worked or a caribou stepped on. But where are the people? What's the story? And he said, oh.
So when you worked in Anchorage, what were the working conditions like, and how did people get along?
Well, that was changing too. When I first went into the office, my first couple of years there, both first 2 years as a seasonal and then as a employee, it was a little contentious because of those words, division, and everybody had their own budget, which they guarded with their lives, and people would like try to sneak getting pictures printed, you know, taking their photos in and giving somebody else's account number, you know. When I first went in, it was still very much divisions, mm-hmm. and everybody worked in their silos. But that changed, and changed pretty quickly over time. Although I can remember shouting matches and Leslie standing up in the middle and just saying, boys, go back to your offices.
So they were in cubicles?
Yeah, cubicles. Everybody was in cubicles. Mm-hmm. Even Leslie was in a cubicle when I first
went. What were they shouting over?
I don't know. In fact, Susan, for the first year she worked there, she would come to me and she would complain that Ted wouldn't talk to her. That she'd go and ask Ted for directions, and he wouldn't tell her what to do. And why that was Ted didn't know Susan worked for him. He thought she worked for Bob Spoody.
And Bob never told him.
No, not until somebody called to, Susan refused to get on a chartered flight. She chartered a fixed wing out. I don't know.
Ted told this story too.
Yeah. So you know that story.
Right.
And so there was that. But there seemed to be forming kind of a nucleus. And we had a lunch table. We were one of the few programs, divisions, that had a lunch table. We had a cultural resource lunch table. And we pretty much all ate lunch every day together. And that was good because we got to know each other as people and mm-hmm. became actually friends.
Right.
And then as time wore on, we became such an incredible nucleus. And when it was Ted and myself and Steve Peterson and Gary Summers and I forget who else was there, man, we worked well together. We really were a team. We all bought in to Ted saying, we're here to support parks.
Do you think that was unusual within the Park Service?
Yes. I think it's unusual for offices. Mm-hmm. When I went to Santa Fe, originally it wasn't like that. And I thought, nah, we're not. It's going to be, we're going to do this. And so once a month I had dinner at my house for my program managers.
Nice.
And we'd all have dinner, and we'd talk, and we'd go to lunch. On Thursdays, the Roadhouse would serve buffalo burgers. And so Otis Half Moon, who is Nez Perce Indian, lovely man. He'd call and he'd go, Tatanka! And we'd all go for buffalo burgers. I just think that's so important. But when I got there, I had archaeologists in 8 different locations.
This was Santa Fe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there were people in Denver and people there and people in Tucson. No. So I spent the next 3 years putting all of everybody but museum services was at the museum center in Tucson, and everybody else was in Santa Fe.
And now in Anchorage, was some of that kind of old school Park Service people and sort of a new generation coming in?
I think
in?
So. And I think that's changing. I think the barriers are coming down with this new generation. I think of, like, people say they hate cubbies. They want private offices, right? Private offices. Got to have private offices. And you look at spaces like for Google, mm-hmm. or some other places where everything's open.
Right.
And it's looked on with suspicion if you go off by yourself in work, because everybody works together. And people who were my age in D.C. they hated that.
Yeah.
They wanted their own private office. They wanted to be able to shut the door and not have to talk to anybody. Well, how do you work as a group if you shut your door and don't talk to anybody? And I think of my nephew, who is early 30s now, was thinking about maybe looking at another job. And he's looking at, he's sitting with me and he goes, oh, I wouldn't even think to apply there. I said, why? He said, look at the picture, private offices. I wouldn't even work in a place like that.
Wow.
They don't work together.
Interesting. Well,
yeah.
The other thing on the Park Service, you had mentioned being a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering how that was for you, being a woman in the Park Service organization.
I had 2 strikes against me. I was a girl historian. How useless could I possibly be? The Park Service had a long tradition of being very male-oriented. I think of it, there were phases. Probably when I first came into the service, the Rangers still ran the Park Service. Everybody you'd meet would talk about, going to FLETC, the Federal Law Enforcement right. Training Center, together. They went through the intake program together. They were, at this park together or that park together. And they used to say, and nothing was better than being an 025. That's the series for the Ranger series. Everybody, if you're not an 025, we don't need you. Then planners took over the Park Service. And everything went through planning. And they controlled the money. Hmm. And they controlled new unit studies. It seems like planning was controlling everything. Well, now the bean counters control the Park Service. The budget weenies. And, of course, there's a prejudice there.
Right? Right.
Where do resource people come in? Well, we never controlled the Park Service. I'm sure Ted gave you his analogy of, I don't know, he has so many of them. We're the stable boys in the king's palace, but truly now, or when I left, it was the budget people.
Right.
They controlled everything. I remember somebody saying to me, you're a GS-15. When are you going to stop letting a GS-7 budget person tell you what you can do? And I said, good luck with that.
But as a woman, did you feel that it was more difficult?
Yes. Not in cultural resources. One, Leslie. We had mm-hmm. Leslie. And 2, there were a lot of women in cultural resources. And Ted is gender blind,
mm-hmm.
completely gender blind. It didn't matter to him. Professionals are professionals.
Mm-hmm.
But outside, yes. And sometimes dealing with superintendents who were from the old Ranger Division. Jack Moorhead, the regional director, right. He was the Ranger's Ranger. And so with him, though, I just went to him and I said, I hear you don't like cultural resource people. I'm going to change your mind. And he says, well, I hope you do. And I did. I got him to go to National Historic Landmark plaquings. No regional director ever did that before. You had to work at it. You had to quit thinking that. Some of it I'll also blame on cultural resource people. We think we know everything. And we think our stuff is more important than anybody else's stuff. And I had a cultural resource person once say to me, I could stop the entire park by using Section 106. Well, that's not what it's for. We're not the Nazis, the cultural resource Nazis, you know? Get over it. Get over ourselves. We're all part of a family here. We're all trying to make parks good. But I was lucky in Alaska because there were so few Park Service people, they couldn't dispense with anybody. And we all did everything. Mm-hmm. If you're out in the field, and we almost all spend our summers in the field, you did everything. If somebody needed you to hold something up for them to nail, it didn't matter if you were a historian or a maintenance worker. You did it. Mm-hmm. We all just did everything. If it needed to be done, you just do it. That's just the way it was. That was the magnificence of that. My career in Alaska, I just look on as the greatest of opportunities. Because like with most things in Alaska, it's not like how they do it outside. Right.
But with any job or career, it couldn't all have been the good things.
No. No, there were times. I worked for a regional director in Denver who was a misogynist who, as my immediate boss said to me, once you get into upper management, or middle management, I guess, upper would be Washington, you sometimes have to make decisions that hurt people. And we all feel bad about that. He takes special joy in that. I had him throw things at me. Mm-hmm. I had him poke me in the face with his finger. He hated me and I hated him too. It was just fine. So no, it wasn't always rosy. There were times in Alaska where I'd get so frustrated because we didn't have the funds, we didn't have the staff. I mean, I was supposed to manage a historic preservation program where the NHLs, I think there's 90 in Alaska, you're supposed to visit them every 3 to 5 years and do a condition assessment on them, okay? So unless you go to Sitka, where there's like 7 or 8, they have more than LA does. I love Sitka. Anyway, it's a lot to get to them. Plus, I was supposed to be doing new NHL studies. I was supposed to manage the grants program, all of this, and I was supposed to do it all on a travel budget of $5,000 a year. That was my full budget. And I had to go back to Washington at least once a year to be told what we're supposed to be doing, which we never paid any attention to anyway. It was insane. To have $1,000 was a lot of money to do something. So it would be so frustrating that we never had enough money. We never had enough staff. The needs of the parks, just for the basics. Every park should have an administrative history, an archaeological overview and assessment, an ethnographic, overview. They should have their collections management plans. They don't, because they never are going to get the money to do them. And then I figured out at one point, I sat down, and every park at that time had 125 reports they had to submit to Washington a year. Whoa. Now that doesn't matter if you were Grand Canyon with 425 employees or your Skagway with 8 employees. You still had to fill out that 125 reports.
Wow.
I sat down with our budget officer, Tom Ferrante, God, he was so much fun, and we figured out that we were reporting on the same dollar 10 different places. It was insane, the amount of reporting.
Yeah.
And accounting you have to do. That would make me crazy. That made me crazy. But the work we did, I loved the work we did. And the people we were with. In fact, for my birthday this year, my sister invited a Alaska Regional Office clan reunion. And so it was great. It was just so much fun.
Yeah, as we were saying before, there is, with Park Service, people do stay connected if they want to.
Yeah.
There are people who stay connected and then people who don't.
But. Well, and people who stay connected with, I put it this way, if someone I read somewhere, so I won't claim I didn't originate it, but I love it. It resonates with me, that you make friends for a reason, a season, or a lifetime. And so there are people in the Park Service that I made friends with for a reason. We were on a task force together or something. People that I made friends with for a season. And then there's some that are lifetimes. And I really treasure the lifetimes. And there are many of them. And we went through a lot. Birthing parks is not easy.
Yeah, well, it sounds to me like, at least in Alaska, those relationships that you built with coworkers and the people in the parks, that really made the difference for
Absolutely.
Something working or not working.
Yes, yes. And that may just be the way I work or function, but it really did. Working with the State Historic Preservation Office, which we did a lot, working with Judy Bittner. Oh, my God, what an incredible person she is. She's smart and dedicated and also politically astute, which you better be.
Mm-hmm.
And so working with her office, we worked great with them. If you looked at the board of Alaska Association for Historic Preservation, Alaska Historical Society, Cook Inlet Historical Society, it was all of us.
Right.
I mean, I was president of Alaska Historical Society for 2 years. I was nominated by Elva Scott from Eagle. I looked at her and I said, Elva, I still work for the Park Service. You folks up in Eagle put up big signs, Pinko Commie Park Service, get out. She says, yeah, but I know you. And times change.
Right.
You know. If historic preservation was being done in Alaska, and by the broad sense of the word, historic mm-hmm. preservation, we were part of it. That's why we were part of Jukebox. That's why
right.
we loved it. It was like, this is phenomenal.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say the other side of that coin is people in parks or in the regions could throw up lots of roadblocks as well if they didn't want something done, correct?
Yes, exactly.
And how do you deal with that?
Some of it you just swallow, and some you cajole, you work it. At one point, I mean, there I was, just a little GS9 historian, and I had a superintendent, the superintendent of Denali. This was when I was first doing compliance.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't do compliance at Denali. So, you know, I go up the chain, not doing compliance at Denali. Okay. Kick it up one more. I got all the way to the regional director. And he says, well, I guess we better have a conversation. So the superintendent came in, and I was there with the regional director. And he says, Sandy tells me you're not doing any compliance. And he says, yeah, we're not. And he says, how come? The superintendent says, I don't want to. The regional director says, okay, thanks. And we left. And I thought, well, that's that. Well, they started doing compliance. Not for everything they were doing, mm-hmm. but they would trickle in 5 or 6 a year. And then after a while, especially when Ann Kane, when they hired an actual cultural resource person,
right.
Steve Martin did that, they got a program going.
Right.
And they also found that having a cultural resource person at the table means they're not just there to be the compliance police. They're not just there to be an archaeologist who digs holes. They're part of that whole park family that says we have parks, and we have parks for a reason. And these cultural resources that are within this park are part of that reason.
Mm-hmm. And were there any projects that got stopped that you wished you'd been able to complete?
None that got stopped. Probably some I had in mind that I think Logan finally finished the history of mining in Alaska. That was important.
Logan Hovis.
Yeah. No, I think anything we finally got the money for, mm-hmm. and we got the wherewithal to do, we were able to do, and that was really good. That was good.
Yeah. I was thinking also about Klondike. I know there's some. Well, probably any park. A history of people in positions and personalities working or not working,
mm-hmm.
to accomplish their goals. Did you come across that?
Well, I think it was rough under Huffman and Sims. People weren't always getting along, and they didn't have many people,
mm-hmm.
and they were faced. And I don't know how much Clay Alderson, mm-hmm. was faced with. But they were faced with a lot of the big decision-making for the park being done by entities outside of the park. Either the regional office when Anchorage was still an area office, or the regional office when Anchorage came in. There was so many fingers in that pie and so many people telling them what to do and not do that I think it's hard to be a superintendent. I think Clay had it better in his later years, probably not in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the decision on historic architecture, that 11 building study was done, and Steve Peterson was
Dave Snow
were down there all the time telling them this, you could do this to this building or you can do that to this building. We're telling them what they could sell in the gift shops. I mean, there was a lot of interference in that park because I think of the nature of the park. And me going down to solve problems for the park, right. with the local community, having public meetings. I think I did. I know two. I want to say maybe even three. I got so that I was really well known on Skagway Air, and
hopefully in a good way.
Oh yeah, they like me.
Well, I do know that they went to some reorganization with the resources department, and
no,
that was after or before you, maybe.
No, that would have been after me, because
when Teresa was hired as head of resources.
Yeah, Teresa was at the end of my tenure in Alaska.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you didn't interact with them at that point much?
No. And I was, once Teresa was there. I think there were issues there, personality issues. Mm-hmm. I don't think Teresa and Carl got along.
Right. But
then
you...
Very different people.
Yeah. And you worked with stuff with Carl.
Yeah, I worked with Carl a lot. Carl is his own person. But his heart is in that park.
Right.
And anything I ever asked of Carl, I got. If I needed something, if he needed something from me, he got it.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I had a really good working relationship with Carl.
I was also thinking about sort of the Park Service in general, how you felt about working within that institutional power structure and bureaucracy, how that worked for you.
Well, probably the interesting thing was when here I am sitting in Washington, D.C. I'm the Deputy Associate Director for Cultural Resources for the Park Service, which means there's an associate director above me and then the director. Well, there's a deputy director, but I mean, I'm where it happens, right? And I had less autonomy than what I was in the Anchorage Regional Office. I mean, the bureaucracy in Washington is just hellacious. And it's, having worked at three levels of the Park Service, in a regional office, and then I did my time at Joshua Tree, and then I was also interim superintendent at Bighorn Canyon and Little Bighorn.
Mm-hmm.
And then working in Anchorage, you were in parks all summer anyway.
Right.
It was like you were part of them. We need all three levels. But what it's about is different at every level. In Washington, it is all about money and politics. And anybody who says it isn't, they're lying. It's all about money and politics. It's the driver. And it should be, because that's what it's about there.
Right.
And I had a management training person come in and say, and I was complaining. I said, oh, my staff here in Washington, most of whom had never done a day's duty in a park, I said, they have no understanding whatsoever of what a park needs, what day-to-day operations of a park is like. And I said, and they think they know everything. And she said, that's all headquarters, not just Park Service. That's headquarters. So you have that. Then at regional offices, if people work well together, the regional offices, the regional office in Western Region, where most of the cultural resource people are in Seattle,
mm-hmm.
which is left over from the old regions, they work together really well too. Maybe it's a Western thing, you know? They communicated well and worked together well. Northeast region seemed to be more stovepiped. Atlanta, they had changeover in staff all the time. So I think they had a hard time getting it going. But they'd work at it. I was on a TMAP, Transitional Management something. Anyway, you're going in and you're mapping what are the conditions are now and making recommendations to a new manager coming mm-hmm. in of where you might want to go in the future. And it's not like in the Park Service, there's a thing called operations evaluation. Operations evaluation is when the regional director sends somebody into a park, or the director sends somebody into a regional office and says, it ain't working, and we're going to fix it.
And that happened in Skagway.
It was an operations evaluation.
Well, I know there was some sort of an evaluation.
Yeah.
And I can't remember. I think it's between Alderson and Noble, somewhere in there.
Uh-huh.
They had some kind of an evaluation, and things got restructured.
Yeah.
And I didn't know if you had known about that. That was...
Yeah, I do remember some of that going on. And I'm sure things changed after Noble, because I remember by the time Clay left, we were saying things like Clay had been there too long.
Mm-hmm.
He was too ingrained in his ways, which weren't necessarily wrong or bad, but they had too many homesteaders.
Mm-hmm.
They had a staff that just about everybody had been there forever.
Right.
And couldn't see any different way of doing things,
right.
You know, which is not healthy. You can't have all new people and you can't have all homesteaders.
Right. So after Skagway, you went Joshua Tree and then Intermountain Region.
Yeah.
And then when did you go to D.C.?
I went to D.C. in 2013.
Okay. And then you retired from D.C.?
I retired from D.C.
And when did you retire?
2016.
Oh.
I left with Obama.
It was time.
It was. Oh, yes. A lot of people left with Obama.
All right.
And they have not been replaced.
No, I'm sure not.
They have not. The Park Service has not had a director since Obama, since the new administration.
They haven't. Well, they
have actings, but we do not have a director.
They put head of interior, but they didn't go down to the park level.
No. I think, I want to say there's 9 associates in Washington. The only one, there's the associate for natural resources is the same one that was there for Obama. There's no associate for cultural resources, hasn't been since Stephanie Toothman left, who was in the Obama administration. She left with Jarvis. No chief of interp. I don't know about facilities. There's budget.
There's got to be somebody in acting in the budget position.
The budget is filled.
Okay.
And I think public affairs or legislative affairs is filled. Other than that, they're all acting.
Well, it sounds you had a very long career with the Park Service.
I did.
And how would you reflect back on that career?
I can't believe the things I got paid to do. I mean, I've been to so many national parks, and I've done meaningful work in the parks. I remember being at a meeting at the Grand Canyon, and every day we ate lunch at the meeting, and we're in this room with no windows, and we're in the meeting, and it's our last day, and they suggested a working lunch, and I said, you know, I heard you got a big hole in the ground around here. I'd like to see it. And so you might not see the hole in the ground.
Right.
Worked with great people. I really had, I think, an excellent working relationship with a lot of the Alaska Native groups, which I treasured. We had an incredible relationship with, I don't know what they changed their name to, but Gordon Puller's program.
Mm-hmm.
When I was there, it was Department of Alaska Native and Rural Development, and I know it's changed its
name.
Oh,
yeah, Ted was talking about you guys did courses for...
Nationwide, a very small percentage of Native Americans graduate from college. Many will go, but a very small percentage actually make it through to graduation. So UAF looked at that and said, we need to solve this. I think in Alaska it was like 1% or 2 or 3%. I don't know. A small percentage of Alaska Native students made it to graduation. And so the Department of Alaska Native and Rural Development was part of looking at that. To enter the program, students had to have at least 2 years of college in. And it was a real program. It was not a pretend program. But much of their work they could do from their village. It was done by computer classes, which are so popular now, but
right.
were innovative then.
This was in the 90s.
Yeah.
Right?
And they had great staff. But they would meet a certain number of times a year, I think it was 4 times a year, in week-long intensive seminars. And one of those was resource management. So we entered into an agreement with Gordon's program, with Gordon and his program, that we would co-sponsor their week-long seminar in resource management, because after all, that's one of the things we're all about, right? And so the curriculum would be set by us, a student representative, and Gordon's and his staff. We would host it in a park. We hosted in Sitka, we hosted in Nome, we hosted at Wrangell St. Elias at Copper Center. And the curriculum would be different for everyone. And it would meet the students' needs.
And it was natural and cultural resource
it
management?
It was resource management, so it would lean towards cultural resource management if they were interested in, say, museums or something
right.
like that. But if it was really focusing on how do we manage this. For Sitka example, they wanted to know, how do you manage a park? And so we had the chief of facilities, we had the law enforcement, we had resource manager, we had museum services, the superintendent, everybody participate, and we had a rule with the week-long seminar. You didn't just participate for your one talk. You had to participate the whole week. Because in being able to communicate one-on-one on a daily basis was an essential part of the class experience. So you weren't just talking heads.
Right.
And we were accessing all forms of learning, of how you learn. You learn through talking heads, but you also learn through touching everything. And so we did that. And that was fantastic. And we ran those students through there. I don't know how many hundreds of students went through that program, and the reviews we'd get back were phenomenal. It would be, we didn't know the, I thought the National Park Service only arrested people, you know, or I didn't know you did this, or thank you so much for the ideas on arsenic in collections. We didn't know about that. And for us, we learned a great deal about the villages people came from and who they were, and we learned how to communicate better. Mm-hmm. So it was a wonderful, wonderful experience, and I'm so sad that after Ted left that they're stopped.
Yeah.
Because the budget people again went, well, what are we getting from this? We're not hiring any Alaska Native people. I said, well, if you paid more money, you might, but you don't pay enough money. And it was just,
yeah.
But that was, oh, I love those. And 1 year I had met Virginia Salazar, now Half Moon, who was the chief curator for Santa Fe when that was its own region, at a meeting. And she is a Santa Clara Pueblo Indian. So she hosted us in Santa Fe 1 year, and we went to Bandelier, and we went to Powwow in Albuquerque. And I mean, it was a fantastic experience.
Yeah.
And another year we were hosted in Arizona, and went to parks there, the small Tonto and Casa Grande.
Cool.
And so it was a great experience.
Yeah. I have another quick Klondike question, which is the Seattle unit.
Yes.
Now, did you have anything to do with them? Because they are in a different region.
They're in a different region, and they were totally managed out of the Seattle Office of National Park Service. I did go down there and meet with them and use their archives some, and just kind of to see what their operation was and how they were interpreting the gold rush.
Mm-hmm.
But
joint projects or anything?
No. Because, again, it's how the funding comes.
Right.
The funding goes to, we get our region funding. That was another region.
Right.
So to do cooperative was really hard.
Yeah. I don't know within the park, it was, you know, the staff in Skagway and the staff in Seattle, how much they cooperate and share back and forth.
I don't
forth.
Think they do. They may now, but yeah, they but didn't
they
used
didn't.
To.
And I was just wondering, from the regional level, you probably didn't have much to do with them.
No, I didn't even know their names.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I've had you talk a very long time. It's been fascinating.
Well, I do ramble on.
No, you've covered so much. It's like beyond Klondike and Skagway. Are there other things that came to your mind when you knew I was going to ask you all these questions?
No, I think...
Have we covered everything?
I think we've covered everything.
And you're
probably even more. And as I said, I tried to not pre-think so it would be a spontaneous conversation.
Right. But any other Skagway, Klondike things?
I just... only other thing that we didn't talk about, and that's about Chilkoot Trail, was there was a huge discussion whether Chilkoot Trail should be managed as a trail or as a historic trail.
What's the difference?
Difference is, if it's a trail and you need to change how the trail goes, you just bulldoze it through and you change the trail. If you don't concern yourselves with tin cans laying along the way. And so there was an effort at one point for facilities management, the maintenance crews, to say, no, we want to just manage it as a recreational trail because it's a lot easier to manage. And it's used a lot as a recreational, similar to a recreational trail, but it is a historic trail.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And so there was a lot of discussion about that. But it stayed managed as a historic trail, which means the route of the trail and items along the way are important to the experience. It's not, you're not hiking the trail just because you get a good view of the inlet or because it's, you could tell your friends, I made it to the top of the Chilkoot Trail. You're hiking it for that experience, so you could say, oh, this is maybe what it felt like for the gold miners coming up through here.
So were you involved in that decision making?
Yes. Yeah, we had lots of discussion. We assisted the cultural resource, assisted Carl in the park, and Ted probably had a lot to do with that.
And you were promoting the historic trail.
It's a historic trail. I mean, it just is. It is right. What it is.
And was part of that discussion about the plan of how you have to camp in certain spots now and get a permit versus
yes.
It used to be you could just hike it?
Yep. Because once you permit and you limit where people camp, you're protecting that historic resource. That's why you need those things.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that was one other thing that just came to mind.
Cool. Well, I'm glad you mentioned it. I hadn't thought about it. So, anything else?
I think...
Summarize your... Well, I know. This is sort of a summary question. You started out doing history, and you ended up as a manager in administration. How do you feel about that change?
I found out that what I was good at was solving problems. And in a way, that's what doing historical research is. But every job I've had, it seemed I've been brought in and given the direction that this needs to be fixed. Even from that first thing with the grants program, this program needs to be fixed. It's not working. Fix it. And I like doing that. I like fixing. And when it's fixed, I'm done. I'm ready to go. I'm ready to move on. Whether it stays fixed after I'm gone or not, not my business. People who've come into jobs behind me, I've said to them, it's your job now. You have to do it your way, not my way. Unless you work for me, and then you're we're all going to have a common goal.
Right.
And it doesn't matter if you get from A to B in a straight line or a curvy line, round the mountain or over the mountain. That's up to the individual to do, but we're all going to agree on where it is we're going to get to. So that's kind of managing. Mm-hmm. And even going into Washington, I was given this has got to be fixed.
And do you feel like you fixed the things you were asked to fix?
Yes.
And in Alaska, what would that have been?
I fixed the compliance program where there was none, and then there became one, and it was not a compliance police program. It was a cooperative program. I fixed that. I fixed park relations with Alaska Native peoples, not by myself, certainly, but that was something I was told we need, and why there was an Alaska Native Issues team, not just a self-governance team, but it was, we need to have a better daily, we work with Alaska Native peoples every day, and we need to have a good working relationship here, and we need to have communication and both ways. We don't just go in and tell people, this is how it's going to be. Hi, we're from the federal government. We're here to help. That never should leave our lips. I think I contributed to that a great deal through the relationship with Gordon's program, through the negotiations under Indian self-governance, through the tribal grants program. I loved doing that. That was so great. And sometimes we'd find out grants that didn't get funded. We'd find a way to get it done. I mean, I remember one project, all they really needed were archival boxes. So we bought them archival boxes.
Yeah.
You know, come on. I loved that. I have a dance paddle from Sitka, where I worked with the, breaks my heart to say that the tribal center there in the park that had been there for 25 years was gone because of the bean counters.
The Southeast
Alaska Cultural Center
is mm-hmm. gone?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
It's been gone for years. The bean counters got rid of it. But I helped them get a grant to put up the totem, the healing totem mm-hmm. in the park.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I know the project.
And when that totem was raised, we were there, and it was first raised in like 100 years in a traditional manner, and pulling on the ropes, and I never forgot, one of the gentlemen, one of the tribal men, called out, "Only men pull the ropes, no women." And the tribal women looked, and I thought, oh, this is Tlingit country. No, no, no. This is a matriarchal society.
Yes.
And everybody pulled the ropes, and they said, "You too, Sandy. You too, Park Service." So we all pulled ropes. And then that night, they had a huge potlatch dinner, and each clan had their own table or set mm-hmm. of tables. And so, you know, there's the Kagwantan, this, and there's NPS. And then the superintendent and I were both presented with dance paddles.
Nice.
And when they'd call out National Park Service, we'd stand up and dance with our paddles. I mean, you can't, those are incredible moments.
Yeah.
And I have to believe that they did make a difference.
Yeah. That was that the Catlin pole?
Yeah.
Yeah. It took me a minute to think of it.
Yeah, I didn't remember myself. Anyway.
Yeah, special moments for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much. That's a lovely note
to
finish on.
Thank you. Oh, my goodness.